Okay, we're going to call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission order on December 10th, 2009. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Commissioner Christensen?
Here.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Here.
Commissioner Melskow?
Here.
Commissioner White?
Here.
Chairperson Christie?
Here. This morning we're very fortunate to have the Morro Bay High School Chamber Choir with us, led by Inspector Barbara O'Donnell. And in the spirit of the holiday season, they're actually going to do a very traditional Christmas carol to open our meeting this morning. And it's called Bring the Torch, Jeanette Isabella. So would everybody please rise for the Morro Bay High School choir.
Okay, very good. I'm sorry, since my mic wasn't on, I'm going to repeat the email address for anyone who would like to open a future planning commission with a patriotic song, dodonn10@netzero.net, and that's Barbara O'Donnell, who's going to coordinate the singers for next year. Okay, the next item on our agenda is public comment. For any item that is not on the agenda, I don't have any speaker slips for public comment this morning. I don't see anyone coming to the front of the room, so I'm going to assume there's no public comment, and we're on to planning staff updates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Warren Hogue from the Planning and Building Department, and yes, I'm back. It's good to be back. Good to see you all.
Welcome.
All I really have at this point is just making sure we all understand what the holiday schedule is for your commission. After today's meeting, we do have a meeting on December 17th in this room at 9 o'clock on the conservation open space element. And then you're off for about a month, and you're back to your regular meeting schedule. Second and fourth Thursdays, January 14th is your next meeting. And at that meeting, you will elect a chairperson and vice chairperson for 2010. That's really all I have at this point, other than to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that Eric Greening wasn't here so I could respond to his public comment. and you can share that with him when you see him and wish him a happy holidays for me. And I'd like to wish you all a happy holidays in case I don't see you at the next meeting.
Welcome back, Mr. Hogue. It's good to see what we can of your face again.
Well, it's temporary.
Okay,
well, because I literally couldn't stand the shave.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's just in time for the cold weather.
Thanks.
We have a special item of commission business this morning. Would Jill Garcia please come to the podium? The Planning Commission doesn't typically do resolutions, but the Planning Commission doesn't really do much typically. So I've asked staff to prepare the following resolution for Jill Garcia, and I'm going to read it into the record. Whereas Jill Garcia is a singer-songwriter living in Morro Bay who has a deep commitment to the vocal and performing arts. And whereas Jill Garcia was one of the first people ever to sing her testimony before the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission on a public hearing item. And whereas that testimony established the fact that the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors chambers does, in fact, have killer acoustics. And whereas that testimony established, whereas Jill Garcia's innovative participation in the public process was the direct inspiration for the Planning Commission to extend an open invitation to local singers, songwriters, and musicians to honor the public and their craft by opening the Planning Commission meetings with song. And Whereas Jill Garcia graciously volunteered to work with the singer-songwriter community to organize a wide range of talented performances throughout 2009, and whereas providing a space for the arts in our public discourse, both literally and figuratively, contributes to a more vibrant, diverse, and resilient democracy. And whereas through her efforts, Jill Garcia has not only enhanced the atmosphere and tone of Planning Commission meetings, but has also served to introduce members of the arts community to the importance of public participation in land use planning. And whereas planning commissioners, staff, and members of the public have thoroughly enjoyed the gift of song, that would not have been possible without Jill Garcia's tireless behind-the-scenes efforts to organize her fellow vocalists. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission recognizes Jill Garcia for her volunteer efforts to promote the interface between the arts and public participation in the democratic process. Be it further resolved and ordered that the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission extends its gratitude to Jill Garcia for her exemplary citizenship and willing to take on this significant responsibility purely for the love of music, song, and shared experience. Thank you, Jill. And this is for you. I don't think folks realize how much actual behind-the-scenes work went into the performances that we've been enjoying all year. Jill and I have been in contact by email and phone weekly, and she's been so incredibly, incredibly responsible in fulfilling this responsibility that she's taken on that I felt her efforts deserve recognition. So,
thank you, Jill.
And on that note, words escape me, but I wish for you to know that your appreciation is heartfelt. I know you go through much turmoil throughout the day, and if we can bring a piece of joy, come what may. So on that I wish...
2006-00051, Supervisorial District Number 1, Karen Knoll, Project Manager.
Good morning, Commissioners. Karen Knoll with the planning staff. I've handed out to you replacement pages. The agenda got a little messed up a little bit, so your page 1-5 through 1-9 should just be pulled out and replaced. And with that, we're here today for the conditional use permit for the Goodell Winery Project. The project is a three-phase project. Includes phase one, 60,000 square feet of tank and barrel storage, and approximately 9,000 square foot administrative office. Phase two is another 60,000 square feet of tank and barrel storage. Phase three is 60,000 square feet of barrel storage. The project also includes approximately 1.5 acres of outside crush area and wastewater and water treatment ponds. At case production, it's anticipated that this project will produce 1.3 million cases of wine. The site is located off Dry Creek Road, at the end of Dry Creek Road. It's in the agriculture category, and it's adjacent to the city of Paso Robles and the Paso Robles Airport. This aerial shows you exactly the location. This is the State Youth Authority, the airport, again, Dry Creek Road, and the site. Another aerial of the site, as you can see, it's fully planted with grapes. There's a couple residences on the house, on the site. And this shows the three phases, and the waste treatment and water treatment will also be phased. This slide shows the the floor plan it built out. And here's the elevations of the site. And this is a little dark slide, but the winery will be located in approximately this area. And this shows what the extension of Dry Creek is going into the city of Paso Robles. With that, the only change I have to the condition is on page 1-9, condition 10. The preamble should read prior to issuance of a grading permit instead of at the time of application. So with that, I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nall. Any questions for staff this time?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I did have some questions, and I wanted to get them out there. I hope that's okay, just in case the applicant wanted to respond to any of those. First of all, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the road improvements in conjunction with the city of Paso Robles and how the fees, would they run through the county or would they be paid directly to the city? And just, I'm not really familiar with how that process might work.
Okay, so this project is conditioned for two different things. One is to do road improvements to Dry Creek Road. So in this, the picture that's still on the slide, or on the slide there, Dry Creek will be improved to the driveway of the new facility. So they have to actually physically do road improvements. And then secondly, they're required to pay into the city of Paso Robles road impact fee. And that's based on the square footage of the project. So it's anticipated to be close to $700,000 is the fee.
Will the city be permitting this road improvement and inspecting, or will the county be handling?
Yes, the it's conditioned that the road improvements will be done through a encroachment permit through the city of Paso Robles. So once the road's done, they will let the county know that it has been done, meeting their standards.
Thank you. And then the next thing was page 1-11, condition 9. Let's see here. Condition 19, I believe it is. We had this come up in a previous hearing with Brett Butterfield's project in Sam McGill. It's about the 10% above what's required for Title 24 requirements. And Chuck Stevenson was sitting here at the podium with us when it came up previously, and he informed us that the Title 24 requirements are being upgraded currently. And so if this project's built in a year or two, it may not be feasible to meet that 10% additional requirement. So I was wondering if we could take that out of here.
Let me do a little research on that.
Miles per hour for dust mitigation. And in our next two staff reports, it specifically is condition 15 miles per hour. So I was wondering if that could be changed to 15 miles per hour.
Yeah, that would be an easy fix on that.
Okay, I just wanted to get it out there again in case the applicant had any concerns with this. And then we talked about the fees. The other one's very minor. It was just on page 1-16. I just wanted a clarification. It's under 38B. It talks about openings in the fence every 100 yards. I know typically we talk in feet. I was just trying to clarify if that means yards or feet.
I believe it is yards.
Okay. That was just a clarification. And then on same page, condition number 41, it speaks to the applicant shall install bird netting or other methods to detract birds from open water storage. This was a request on page 5, I believe it is, of our staff report from the Airport Land Use Commission. And they were specific that they wanted bird netting that entirely covers the open water area. So other methods, I didn't know what might fall under that, and if that's something that we should tighten up a little bit, but maybe the applicant has some more information on that.
Yep, that change of wording was at the request of the applicant because there are new ways to detract birds,
okay.
And I believe the agent would have an answer for us.
Would we want to add language that possibly would to the satisfaction of the Airport Land Use Commission?
That would be a good solution.
Okay. Again, just so the applicant can think about these things. And at this point, that's the extent of my questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions from commissioners?
I have.
Mr. Melskow?
I have one. I'm just wondering on the buildings, which have a gigantic roof on them, if they would be suitable for solar panels in the future?
I'll let the agent answer that one.
Yeah, okay.
To my right, questions?
Just a couple more questions. Following up on Commissioner White's questions about the road improvements, I'm still not clear. It sounded to me like there were three parts of the road improvement requirement, the driveway part, or the road paving that you addressed, mm-hmm. and the Paso Robles impact fee portion. And then it looked from the letter from the city that the third part was the participation in the Highway 46 and Airport Road intersection project group. So I was looking for a little more follow-up on that requirement. It sounds like participation is sort of vague.
Exactly.
From our discussion previously, if you'd just follow up on that.
I can answer that at this point. Airport and 101, it's at level of service F at the moment. The circulation study has been done through Paso Robles. They have not quite adopted it yet, but the goal of the city of Paso Robles is they're going to take traffic off of Airport, and Dry Creek will then be funneled with a lot of the traffic. So the goal of that would be Airport will no longer be at F because of other improvements made in the area, and the impact fee that this applicant is paying to the city will help facilitate that. But then getting back to that intersection, it is a relatively simple fix. The intersection needs to be widened. There's a winery on one side and the water park in the other. Both need to extend a little bit. The city of Paso Robles asked this applicant to participate in a problem that's already existing, but they do not have a specific plan. They don't have drawings or cost estimate. And how the city operates for projects in the city is they ask their applicant to agree to participate. We felt that was a little too vague. We didn't know what this applicant was participating in. And without having cost estimate, we didn't know what our applicant's proportional share would be. So with assistance with Caltrans, Caltrans really is the lead on this. They felt that paying into the city's fund was more than adequate to address the issues on this intersection.
Okay, and did the city agree to that? Because it looked like from the letter that we have that the city requested both the payment of the fees into the fund and participation. And so I just wasn't sure that was clearly spelled out in our requirement or if the city had agreed
agrees that this will be a fix. I think in a perfect world they would want this applicant to participate in the intersection as well. But we felt there was nothing for our applicant to participate in.
And what the deferral option mentioned in the conditions is?
Had some discussions with Ted Bench yesterday, and the only portion of this project that will be required to pay the inclusionary housing ordinance fee will be the office administration building. Winery buildings are specifically exempt from that fee. What I calculated is the office is the full fee for this 9,000 square foot office would be $22,000, the full fee. And as you know, currently an applicant will pay 20% of that full fee till 2011. And the 20% of that is $4,400. So that's what we believe if the applicant was going to file a building permit in the next year, that would be the fee that they'd pay.
Because that would change then if they opted for the deferral and the changes next year, then that would be at the higher
rate. Actually, because the board voted not to change the fee next year. They're going to keep it at the same level.
Yeah, till 2011 and then go on from there. But the deferral, thank you for reminding me about the referral. A deferral is you can defer the fee to final. So the fees will be set when you apply for the building permit, but you won't have to pay them till you final the building permit.
So that was
that's the only part of deferring on a construction application.
Oh, that, okay, and I just bring this up because this is amongst the first of the structures that are required to pay the inclusionary linkage fee. Mm-hmm. Since it's not still approved in the coastal zone. So I was kind of curious how that works out then, since we haven't seen very much of it. And the other question may be more to the applicant. We discussed earlier about height. We're not looking at a variance here, but there's some discrepancy. The height limit is 35 feet, and we got a project that's a couple feet over that.
And as I wrote the condition, when we get elevations like this, we're not sure where that the measurements are taken from. So the condition is worded so that they show us that it's measured from average natural grade. In discussions with the agent, he believes that the measurements were taken for finished floor, so that maybe that the buildings should meet it. But I'll have the agent discuss that in more detail.
So from your understanding, then, that difference between the finished floor and the average natural would mean the same thing, that it does fit under the definition of the 35-foot requirement.
Yeah, and that's why we word the condition to show us how the measurement is made and show us that you meet the ordinance.
Okay. So we'll hear more from the applicant then on that one. Thanks.
Any other questions? I just have one question about the city's road impact fees. Have we conditioned a project in the county in the past to pay into a city's road impact fees? Have we ever done that before?
I'm sure we have. And Warren, do you recall, I can't put my finger on one, but paying into the City of Paso Robles road impact
fee. I believe there's
fee.
Precedent for that. I can't remember a specific example. Maybe Mr. Marshall can help us.
Glenn Marshall, County Public Works. I believe River Road, we saw an expansion of the gravel pit, and I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name, but they were conditioned to pay into the city's
So road. That was a very recent
a very
application.
Recent.
Because I recall having conversations on this commission when the city was asking for that, and this commission thought it was reasonable, and we were told that there was no mechanism to require a county applicant to pay into a city fund. So I just want that on the record that is, in fact, there is a mechanism for that, and it's appropriate, and we are affirmatively now going to be considering that in applications as they come forward.
These are recommendations that we get from the city, so it's at your discretion whether you accept the recommendation.
Okay.
With the City of San Luis Obispo, there's actually a memo of agreement that was approved by the board requesting the applicants within the fringe area pay fees.
Right, because we definitely required that on some of the airport area projects to pay into city.
It, because there's an existing MOU. But I think it may have been the sand and gravel mines from last year where we were talking about road impact fees. Or it may have been a different project. I don't recall the specific project, but I do recall the gist of the conversation. So I'm glad to see that we've figured out a way to do that and that staff is recommending that. I think that's an appropriate direction to go in.
You know, I don't know if this is an ex parte, but I did ask that question of Supervisor Meacham yesterday because this did appear odd to me, and I didn't know how well it might work and if this was new ground, and he informed me that, no, this has been done in the past.
Because they just did it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even you referenced another project that's a couple years old anyway.
Okay,
so.
Good.
But following up on that, what's the difference then between having the MOU and not, if we have it with the City of San Luis and not Paso?
I don't know the history of the MOU with the City of San Luis Obispo.
And still exists for custom crush facilities. This, as Karen mentioned, is a 1.3 million case facility at about 4 tons per acre. That represents 5,000 acres of fruit that could stay in the county to be processed into wine. With that, I'll just simply jump to the questions and then be available to answer your questions. With respect to Title 24, it's really not a question of if it's changing. January 1st, 2010, the new Title 24 goes into effect. It is significantly stricter in some ways than the existing Title 24, specifically steel buildings, pre-engineered steel buildings. And it's a very, very good change. Steel buildings tend to transmit energy through the steel because there isn't a thermal gap. Steel buildings now will be required to be clad with insulation on the outside of the steel structure, creating a thermal gap. So it's a significant improvement to steel buildings. To say that we couldn't exceed Title 24 by an additional 10%, we certainly could. Is it onerous? Yes, it is with the new Title 24. So if there is latitude, given the new Title 24 goes into effect January of next year, we would appreciate that. With respect to the bird netting, full netting over a winery wastewater pond creates some issues for us. The ability to service the mechanical equipment, the aerators, is compromised. And it does create some residue or scum on the surface of the pond that actually degrades water quality slightly. The state-of-the-art approach actually is stainless steel wires in one direction only. I don't know the exact spacing. I think it's somewhere between 6 and 18 inches on center. The aeration of the water actually prevents birds from wanting to stay in the pond environment, and then this wire really is the second set of insurance. So that's the alternative that we would suggest would be this unidirectional wire as opposed to full netting. With respect
to excuse me, could I jump in right there?
Yes.
Do you know if that's if that would be acceptable to the Airport Land Use Commission?
I haven't specifically talked to the Airport Land Use Commission, but I would expect if we showed them some other applications of it, my gut tells me that they would accept it, and I would certainly not oppose a condition that requires us to take the solution back to them.
Okay, thank you.
With respect to solar, without question, we would put collateral load on this building to allow the addition of solar panels, and we certainly are recommending it to all of our winery clients. In addition to that, as a side note, I will mention that there's a new technology that we're pushing, and it is solar panels that are actually floated in the winery wastewater ponds. So you're not, if you have a roof that's not conducive to solar panels, in this case we do, but if you have a roof that's not conducive to solar panels, you can avoid taking agricultural land out. You can actually float them in the ponds. There are several applications of that up in Northern California, and we actually are looking at that on one of our winery projects here in the county now.
It's being done already?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
How does that work with the aeration of the pond?
The way that they're floated, it seems to work just fine. We're actually starting to move away from the aerators that are the type that float on the top of the pond in favor of something that's called microjet, and it actually is fed, delivered to the bottom of the pond, and the oxygen floats up through the entire pond environment. They're a bit more efficient, both in terms of energy and in terms of cleaning the water. With respect to the height, Karen, could you put up the site plan, please? To clarify, the heights on our elevations actually were measured from finished floor elevation, not from average grade, and I apologize for that oversight. That said, the larger building, the Phase 1 and Phase 3 building, its height above average grade is actually down about 30, 31 feet just because of the lay of the existing land. However, the Phase 2 building, actually, height above average grade is presently at 35 foot 10 inches. We certainly would not want to exercise the option of taking the roof slopes up to 4 and 12 and make these buildings 10 feet taller than they already are. And we certainly can reduce the roof slope down to stay within 35 feet. Most people probably wouldn't notice it. Personally, I like the proportion of the slightly steeper roof. So I would ask the latitude of the commission to allow the heights to be as high as 36 feet above average grade. If anybody has heartburn about it, I'll certainly back away from that, but I think from a proportional standpoint only, having that latitude I think would be a plus. And with that, I think I'll attempt to answer any additional questions.
We did have some questions that have been raised by the commission with respect to the 15 mile per hour restriction.
No issue there.
Certainly no issue there?
No.
And any questions for the applicant at this point?
I was just checking to see if we covered them all, yeah. And you caught the 15 mile, and I think that's all that I had.
Okay.
Yes, just, well, my other concern about the intersection, the 46 and Airport Road, so I was just looking over the letter.
Caltrans, and I guess the way that I will categorize it is that at the end of the day, the city asked for three things. They, of course, are not the lead agency. They're an advisory or consulting with respect to this. I believe all parties agreed at the end of the day that first and foremost they were interested in the city fees. That's well in excess of $700,000. Secondarily, they wanted Dry Creek Road paved, and there clearly is a nexus for that. And then the third item was, gee, would you participate in this? We have the winery, we have the water park, and I believe there were two or three other projects that were city projects that had agreed to that. At the end of the day, Caltrans and the city agreed that between the city fees and the paving of Dry Creek Road, we met the project-specific mitigations as well as cumulative mitigations, and that those fees would be earmarked for the Dry Creek Road intersection as well as the airport and Dry Creek intersection, and that that met our obligations.
So that's your understanding and staff's understanding then of the agreement, so not hearing otherwise from the city. Take that, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Woodle, Commissioner Melsko had mentioned the possibility of solar panels on your roof, and you said you're intending to put solar panels on your roof.
To clarify, no, what I said is we're recommending solar panels, and we are putting what we call collateral load in the structure. In other words, we're designing the buildings to accept the solar panels.
Would it help your recommendation if the commission were to add a condition to the project to require solar panels on the roof?
I suppose that it would.
Okay. And then I had another question about the roof. I was noting the Ag Commissioner's recommendation to require drought-tolerant landscaping around the for screening. I wondered if you had at all considered water catchment off that great big roof.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so are you intending to do that as well?
We are intending to
okay.
do that, yes.
Well, is that going to be used for irrigation?
It will be used for irrigation. The procedure that we're presently implementing is we're catching the water, and then we're sending it to the polishing pond, which helps to dilute the salts and the BOD in the ponds to make it more applicable to vineyard application and ornamental winery
okay.
or ornamental irrigation. So
okay.
the short answer is yes.
So ultimately it does get to the irrigation use.
Yes,
just
it does.
Not directly. Okay, that's terrific. Those were my only two questions.
I did have one more with your question. Is the applicant agreeable if we can eliminate the 10% additional requirement over Title 24 to accept the condition for the solar panels?
No.
All right. Good try, though, Bruce.
So that means you want us to keep the 10% over Title 24.
The solar panels, this is obviously a hugely capital-intensive project in a very, very soft economy. Solar panels for this project is probably a $3 to $4 million investment, and it's a great investment, and I would strongly recommend it. I'm not in a position to accept it as a condition.
Okay.
Thank you
very much for your testimony. Okay, we'll bring it back to the commission and staff. Does staff have any responses to anything you heard?
Karen Nall, just that we would have no opposition to the increased height. The ordinance allows you to go to 45. You would just be basically waiving that roof pitch. The ordinance says you can go to 45 with a 4 and 12. They're asking to go 36 with less than a 4 and 12.
Okay.
I had just, I'm okay with the extra foot on the roof. I don't hear anyone suggesting this is a bad place or any visual impact issues. But I did have one more question then about the screening and the prime farmland conversion, because we did have some notes from the Ag Department, and I just wanted to make sure that their recommendations are being followed in terms of the screening being cut back or brought closer to the building and in the road right-of-ways.
Yes, absolutely. When we submit a final landscape plan, we will abide by that. It makes all the sense in the world. In this case, getting the screening, since the building is observed from such a distance, getting the screening closer to the building would probably be more effective anyway. So we have no issue with that condition.
Okay, seemed to make sense, but I wanted to make sure that was all in there.
Okay, is there anything, any other items that commissioners want to kick around here? Let's then go through the conditions one by one and see how, whether and how we want to change them. I think the first suggestion by Commissioner White was on page 111.
19, or somebody's changed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was...
19. I don't know. We didn't hear any argument from the applicant. Of course, it allows more flexibility to strike it. But as we see, we're striving to do better, and we have required it in the past. So.
Well, the reason I picked up on it when I read the reports because we specifically struck that at Mr. Stevens' direction off the Brett Butterfield project in San Miguel. Vital 24 requirements that are coming down. Mr. Stevenson said with time, this may be a pretty excessive burden, and it may be difficult to meet.
Okay, well, I'm not going to hold to that. I understand with the changing Title 24, that may be too much, but I'm also... in favor of pushing a little higher. And
I'm just going by what Mr. Stevenson said previously because my only concern is consistency with the applicants here, that we're not treating them differently. And the applicant at the Brett Butterfield requested that that be removed, and we did at Mr. Stevenson's suggestion.
Which remind us in the difficulty of letting things slide.
Right. Yeah.
if we're going to treat people fairly and we decide to drop... the added requirement.
What Mr. Stevenson said in that hearing is a little bit different from what Mr. Whittle just said. Mr. Stevenson said that he thought it would be extremely onerous to meet 10% below the new requirements or above the new requirements.
Steph wanted to weigh in on this, and
it sounds like Warren has some
comments. I think one suggestion I'd have is in that third line, 10% above what is required by Title 24 requirements, you could add at the time of this approval. So that would apply, and then if they come in for the building permit in 2010, then they're subject to the new Title 24 requirements if it isn't at least 10% above the current Title 24 requirements.
I don't know. That seems kind of overly semantical. I kind of look at Title 24, again, sort of as the floor, not the ceiling. I'm with Commissioner Wyatt about, you know, maintaining our... flexibility to be, you know, more aggressive than the state standards in terms of energy efficiency and those sorts of things. I don't know that 10% over the new 24 is onerous or extremely onerous or slightly onerous. but I do know that there are communities and designers who are building buildings that are far more energy efficient than Title 24. I know it can be done. I know it is being done, and it's just a question of how much we want to push that energy efficiency standard. And I'm willing to support the condition as written with 10% over if there's three commissioners that support that. I'm not going to fall on my sword over it.
I'd like to see what Mr. Whittle has to say.
If I might, I would really suggest that for metal buildings, what we are going to be doing in 2010 is going to exceed the present Title 24 by 20%, 30%, 40%. I don't know the number, but it's a huge number. They're going to be so much more efficient. So I really think that this project is far exceeding the spirit of this condition. However, if you choose to leave it in, I would really suggest that you strike D, E, F, G, and H, because none of them are in Title 24. This is a condition that's fairly awkwardly worded. Not that these aren't noble things to do, but they have absolutely nothing to do with Title 24. And that said, given that pre-engineered steel buildings are going to be so much more efficient, I think this project is really exceeding the spirit of this condition.
But those conditions don't apply to Title 24. It says the applicant, so that's the 10% over 24, and then it says the applicant shall also incorporate design and operational measures,
blah, blah, blah,
in a number of ways. So that's over.
I stand corrected.
I'm not going to support the keeping of the 10% in there. I remember Mr. Stevenson's comments at the time, and I think just at this point, assuming, and I am making the assumption that this project is going to be built under the new Title 24 requirements, I'm happy to stick with that for now, and maybe in another couple of years we'll start adding some more percentage points, but at this point I'm going to not support that.
So then condition number 19 will be modified to remove the reference to 10% over Title 24.
But what about a compromise leaving in the... sort of recommended design and operational measures.
All we're doing is striking the 10%.
Just striking the 10% above, so the rest is staying.
A through H, okay, intact.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
So let's see, on to page 113, that was condition number 24. We're going to change 25 to 15 there, miles per hour. And then on page 116, that dealt with the bird, the birds and the ponds, I had a little wince when I saw the other, the reference to other measures.
Omitted.
Which part?
The relating to Title 24, and just start with the applicant shall incorporate design and operation measures to reduce long-term greenhouse gas emissions, starting there.
Okay, wait, let me.
I believe so. Just strike the first part and then strike also in that chapter shall. I think that would do it.
No, let's clarify because I'm not clear on what you're suggesting here.
Are we striking all reference to Title 24?
No, I thought you said we weren't.
I have a recommended rewording if you'd like to hear it. In that third line, just delete the words increase by 10% above what is. So it would read, applicant shall submit plans demonstrating that the building energy efficiency rating shall be, what is required by Title 24 requirements.
So, shall meet Title 24 requirements?
Well, shall be what is required.
That's just an easy strike. Okay.
Then you're just striking out increase by 10% above.
Right.
That's really not needed because
the
requirement anyways, it's the building codes. I'd suggest
that's why it was a little
strike that and just say upon application for construction permit, the applicant shall...
Or you can just say,
design and operation measures.
You just say, upon application for construction permit, subject to Title 24 requirements, the applicant shall submit plans.
Yeah,
the applicant shall also incorporate design and operational measures into the project, and just forget all the stuff about upon application for construction permit, subject to Title 24 requirements, the applicant, then just skip the rest of that whole sentence and then say, and start with, the applicant shall also incorporate design and operational measures into the project to reduce blah, 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 blah.
So it's just one sentence?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that make sense to commissioners?
Yes.
Are you good with that, Bruce?
Yes.
Dean, good with that?
I don't, but then it looks like, though, that's requiring these things, and I saw the majority of you didn't want to require them.
These look like suggestions to me. The applicant.
But the way that's reading is the applicant shall, not the applicant may. The applicant shall do all this.
Well, it's two sentences. The applicant shall also incorporate design and operational measures into the project to reduce long-term greenhouse gas emissions. This
they
can
get
be
to
accomplished
pick.
In a number of ways, including but not limited to.
Yeah, they get to pick. It's not saying they have to do every single one, A through H.
But they have to do some of
they
it.
They have to do
they
some of it.
They have to reduce.
Okay, I'm fine with that. Yeah. I just want to make sure our intention
and they
is
can do it
they
with,
have to do some of it.
They can do it with other ways, such as the new technology for the metal building that Mr. Whittle spoke to. So that
well,
could
except,
apply here.
Except that's required under Title 24.
Well, they're exceeding Title 24, though.
Oh,
so that would be another way to achieve this. The way I understand it, anyway.
Okay. Okay. So I think Commissioner Christensen's language works for the intent of the commission on that one. And then, we got 8B. I think those were all of the conditions that we wanted to change. Is there any further discussion? Okay.
Bird netting...
Bird netting was subject to satisfaction of the airport land.
That was 41. What and 38B, did that get changed? I thought there was something there.
I have an 8B that needed change. I don't have a 30.
Yeah, no change was needed to 38.
No.
That was
no.
just a clarification of whether it was yards or feet.
Right.
Okay, no change. No, that's my list.
Okay. So I guess it's time for a motion.
With that, I'll make a motion that we adopt the negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section 21,000, et cetera. Approved conditional use permit DRC 2006-00051 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions as modified listed in Exhibit B.
I'll second that.
It's been moved by Commissioner White and seconded by Commissioner Melskow. Clerk, please call the roll.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Yes.
Chairperson Christie?
Yes. Permit is approved.
Okay, on to item number two.
Hearing to consider a request by Jason Moore for a conditional use permit. County file number DRC 2007-00011, Supervisorial District Number 3, Michael Conger, Project Manager.
Good morning, Chair Christie and members of the Commission. Michael Conger, County Planning Staff. This project is a request for a conditional use permit by Jason Moore. The conditional use permit will cover a few different activities. The first one is to permit unpermitted grading that had occurred prior to issuance of permits, and that grading covered an area of approximately 10 acres. In addition to Dan's land use category, and almost all of the site is within the geologic study area, the project applicant also owns some other land totaling over 700 acres, which includes several different land use categories. The subject parcel itself is about 103 acres. So I'm going to go through a little bit of the project history. There's been a manufactured residence established on the site since 2000. Building permits and grading permits were obtained to establish that residence. In July of 2006, our department received an application for demolition of that manufactured residence. And as part of the application process, one of the first things we do is we send a copy of that application to the building inspector, and a building inspector does a site check to look for any things on the site that they'd like to communicate back to the building division staff. And during that site check, the building inspector observed that some recent grading had been done to widen the road going up to the manufactured residence. So a code enforcement case was subsequently opened and a notice of violation was sent. To rectify the violation, the applicant submitted an as-built grading permit application in January of 2007. The scope of the work on that application focused only on the widening of that road leading up to the manufactured residence. Because this involved grading on slopes of 10%, it was sent upstairs to County Planning to do CEQA review, and County Planning did a site visit and noticed that in addition to that road widening, a new road had been extended up to an area that had also been recently graded to create building pads. And so we had subsequent meetings, and it was determined that a conditional use permit was required. A conditional use permit is required because this is in the rural lands land use category, and if you're trying to establish a single-family residence and the grading exceeds 3 acres, that requires conditional use permit approval. And as part of the process through the CEQA review, biological reports and engineering geology reports were required. Those reports were peer-reviewed, and so that added on to some of the time that this application took. In addition, there has also been involvement of other agencies. Because grading exceeded 1 acre, the regional board needs to issue a general construction permit. Because there is a stream bed alteration involved, the Department of Fish and Game would be involved. Because there are wetlands on the site, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Army Corps of Engineers would be involved as well. So here's a few pictures of the site. These were taken back in February and March 2007, so it's not necessarily indicative of what's on the site today. A lot of grasses have grown up around these areas, so they are a lot more stabilized than what's shown in the picture today.
Mr. Conger, is that netting or is that pixelation in the photo?
On the top left photo?
Yeah, where you have that sort of bare, exposed dirt. Our screens look kind of...
I think it's only hay, but I'll have the applicant's representative speak to that as well. So these are some of the pictures of the access road. Additional pictures. The top picture is showing what it looks like from Black Walnut Road and Sea Canyon Road. It's only minimally visible. There's a lot of intervening vegetation, so visibility is not the most significant concern on this site. The lower picture shows a hairpin turn. This is one of the areas that will require remedial grading to bring the access up to CAL FIRE standards.
So we're looking at two violations here, the road in the foreground with the hairpin turn.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the illegal...
That's
grading.
Part of the illegal grading.
And the arrow points to kind of a road in the distance. Is that
Is that what we're looking at with the arrow?
That's a view from back. There are two different pictures. You can't see the
pictures.
Line between.
There are two different pictures?
Yeah, yeah, there's a line between. It's not really showing up on the screen.
Oh, okay.
I
thought it was a really, really, really big ceiling.
Right. The telephone pole doesn't have a bottom.
Got it. Yeah, I see that now.
This is a photo of the building pad, and this was shortly after we had some heavy rains, so you can see some ponding occurring there. Actually, the grading that had been done, there were some sedimentation and erosion control devices put on the site. In this instance, you can see that hay was spread across the building pad, and that does help to reduce the erosion, as that would dissipate the energy from raindrops hitting the soil. This is an aerial image that was taken by code enforcement, and you can see the building pad area. The access road is shown at the bottom left, and then this is where the new single-family residence would be located. The shed is located on an upper terrace, and then there's a road progressing towards the east from there, and that road will be restored. There's a spring and impoundment located in this area, and as part of this project, they will be putting in three culverts to lead from that impoundment to this drainage. And that drainage area will be restored as well, and that heads towards a wetland area. And then here's another photo of the shed, and you can see the fill slope here. And this is the site plan. I'll try to walk you through this briefly. The gate and entrance, and then a guest house. The equipment barn has a garage on the lower floor, a workshop on the upper floor. And we are recommending conditions on the workshop component to remove a restroom that's on the upper floor, and to make sure that the sink is only a workshop style basin and wouldn't be conducive to converting that area to living space, for example. And then a greenhouse and a shed as well. I also want to point out that there is an imbalance in the grading proposed in order to accommodate the distances, and that imbalance would necessitate the exportation of just over 14,000 cubic yards of material. That was reduced from the original project design, which had over 25,000 cubic yards of exportation. The reason for the exportation is that certain grading practices are required to comply with the engineering geology recommendations, and then to spread the spoils across the site would potentially impact other biological areas. So it was determined that it would be more favorable to export than to spread on the site. Staff did distribute a memo last week regarding condition number 11, and that's a condition requiring drainage plan review. And that memo was precipitated by a site visit that staff had with a neighboring property owner and a representative from the applicant. The neighbor was concerned with some possible erosion occurring on a cut slope on his property that may or may not have resulted from drainage from the moor site going on towards that hillside. So through the drainage plan review process, Public Works will be looking at drainage conditions, and we'll try to make sure that drainage does not affect any downhill neighbors. And so we're recommending that the wording be added to specifically have the engineer certify that there will be no changes to the velocity or volume of the drainage heading towards that hillside from what has historically occurred. And so there's a few pictures of the sloughing that had occurred on that hillside here. And these are three pictures, in case you can't see the line. There's a picture here, a picture here, a picture here, and there's...
So this is the neighboring parcel that we're seeing here.
This is on the neighboring parcel, correct.
And where is the property line?
The property, you can see a fence here. This is actually an adjacent property. Actually, this would probably be better if I went back to the site plan. Go back there. This is occurring at the top left of the screen. So the drainage is potentially coming down the road and then diverting in this direction to where that hillside is.
So that hillside is just how far past the property line?
It's very close to the property line where this road is. So if I go back to those last images, the road is... On the far right image, you can see there's a car. Well, actually, it's not very visible on the screen, is it? But there's a car here, and this is the road right here. This is Happy Trails Road that goes to the property gate.
And this is the road, this whole road has been illegally created, graded?
Happy Trails Road was permitted with the original permit for the manufactured residence. There were portions that were widened without permits, which brought this in as an as-built grading permit in the first place. And then beyond the manufactured residence, all of that was a new road.
Okay. So it was the widening here that maybe wasn't done to code?
You know, Mr. Conger, from the photo there on the top left, it doesn't appear to be any surface rutting above the sloughing on the other side of the fence. Could this just be subterranean water seepage that lost this bank here, or is there other rutting that's not visible by this picture?
I think this picture shows that particular area, but I'm not an engineer, so I can't really speak too much to it, although we did have a representative from the applicant's engineering firm there, and the suggestion was made that there were a few different contributing factors, and part of it is that this cut slope is very steep. This is a lot steeper than what we would allow today, but this has been here for a very long time. And on top of that, this is potentially in a landslide area.
That's what it looks like to me, like a subsurface slide. You know, I'm not an engineer either, but just from experience, it doesn't look like it's surface erosion. But, like, you know, maybe the applicant can speak to that. So, thank you.
And so that pretty much concludes the presentation. Staff's recommendation is that your commission adopt the mitigated negative declaration and approve the conditional use permit based on the findings in Exhibit A and the conditions in Exhibit B, with modifications to condition number 11, and Commissioner White also pointed out that condition number 20, which is on page 216, is actually duplicitous of condition number 18, so we are going to recommend that 20 be stricken, and that 21 through 51 be renumbered as 20 through 50. Additionally, in the staff report, there was a reference to the distance separation between guest house and single family residence.
That anyway, my question. So that's
okay.
Good. You already cut that. Okay. Didn't make any sense.
So that concludes my presentation. I'm available
okay.
For any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Conger. We're getting close to our morning break time. Do we want to ask questions of staff now, or when we come back from break? Are we feeling a biological need to take a break? Okay. Commissioner Christensen, this is your territory.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for the good report, Mr. Conger. And I do want to mention I very much appreciated your general comments on the value of applying for permits ahead of time instead of, you know, the bad effects of unpermitted grading. It was very well articulated and perhaps should be put in stone above the... by the entrance to San Luis Obispo County. Yes, exactly. Permitted is different from unpermitted. I just had a couple questions. One of them was being not that familiar with land use categories. Several times you used the agricultural standards, specifically with fencing, and I just rural lands are a type of agricultural property.
Rural lands is a separate land use category from agriculture,
mm-hmm.
But in the land use ordinance, there is a reference for open wire fencing of any height within the rural lands and agriculture land use category being exempt from land use permitting requirements.
Okay, so in that situation, they're kind of similar. Okay. The other question I had was about the laundry facilities, and you had mentioned this on the top of page 2-6. It said that the laundry facilities are not allowed in guest houses, but you said they're going to be in a pool structure. Do you know why they're in the pool structure? Are there none in the house, or is there just these are additional laundry facilities?
There are additional laundry facilities, and perhaps the applicant might speak to why they're proposing to have those. It's actually in the changing room component of the workshop portion of the pool structure.
Okay, good. And thank you for clarifying about guest houses. And then my next question is on page 2-9, top of it, requiring where you discuss that you say that the staff's not recommending that they underground the utilities. And the only concern, and I understand why you're recommending that, the only concern I have is it seems like you've had a couple complaints from neighbors about fencing, and so are you concerned that there might be complaints from neighbors about you know, wires and telephone poles and that kind of thing, or is that kind of standard what's going on out there from what I could tell?
It's pretty standard in rural areas, especially when the parcel sizes are larger than 5 acres,
right,
to do overhead utilities. I haven't heard any particular complaints about utility lines in that area.
Right. Okay.
I think the fencing complaints were largely due to the fact that there is barbed wire on the top of the fence.
Oh, okay. All right, good. Thank you, and that was it for now.
Okay. Commissioner White?
Oh, no, that's it. Yeah, that's it for now.
Any questions, Commissioner White?
Yes, I had a few as well. On the neg deck on 291, 2-91, I did have a question about the water calcs. I think we got a mistake in our water calcs. You catch that too, Dean?
I've got that.
After you last time, I looked at it more carefully, too. And it looks like we got a water calc of 0.02. And so I'm pretty sure we're going to use a little more water than that inside the house.
0.02 equates to 17.9 gallons per day. That's a seven-minute shower.
Is that the same situation
no,
as with the
no,
last project?
Before we took out the zero and it was 0.15. So I imagine they mean 0.2 here. Is that
right? That's what I'm guessing. But I want to get into that, too. I think the standard calcs for a house are 0.2. But we had a 10,000-square-foot house here with I don't know how many rooms and bathrooms. So I'm not sure why we would use our standard house that would, our standard calc that we would use for a two-bedroom, one-bath house for this 10,000-square-foot house.
In most cases on single-family residences, we just have to use the estimate because it really isn't the size of the structure, I'm told, that weighs heavily into the water use as much as it is the number of people that are occupying the structure. And it could be a 10,000-square-foot house that only has two people occupying it. It could be an 800-square-foot house that has, you know, six or seven people occupying it. There's no real way to regulate the number of people occupying a structure. So in general, on single-family residences, we only use a standard calculation.
Okay, well, maybe that's more of a discussion item. So maybe I'll stick to my first, specific here that we do want 0.2 acre-feet and not 0.02.
I believe that's the case. From using the spreadsheet quite a bit, 0.02 does sound quite a bit low. But in comparison to the outdoor use is far greater than the indoor use in most projects.
Granted, as far as infrastructure and service and water of 22,000 square feet of stuff.
Well, regarding water, this is over a 103-acre site, and there is a spring on the site, which could be a potential source of water. We don't consider it to be a water issue on the site because there is so much area. The chances are that they're going to be able to find a sustainable source of water. We don't have any known water issues in this area. And, in fact, there's some residential rural zoning down the hill along Sea Canyon Road where 5-acre parcels and 10-acre parcels are common, which suggests that the area can support development on 5- and 10-acre parcels. Since we've only got two primary residences on 103 acres, we didn't see this as being a potential concern with that.
And is this an average amount of development, then, or footprint for the area?
It's not typical to have this amount of development on a single parcel, although there are some old ranch parcels in this area that have like five or six single-family residences on them. But when considered with other land use categories that allow a greater density of development, I don't think that this is out of the ordinary for the Sea Canyon area.
Maybe we'll come to that some more in discussion later, and the size of the house and the footprint. As far as impacts go, high fire zone, 15-minute response time, is that also ordinary, or?
Quite a bit of our county is in the high and very high fire severity areas, and there are quite a few areas that have 15 to 20-minute response times, some areas with more than 20-minute response times.
Okay, so that's also not outside of the norm.
It weighs into minimum parcel size, but not development. So if they were to pursue subdivision of this parcel, chances are they wouldn't qualify because of the fire response time, because of the slopes, because of the geologic study area, and that sort of thing.
So you don't think then it would be allowed to further split up this parcel?
I'm pretty sure that this parcel is at its minimum already.
And that leads then to my other question as far as how this parcel fits into the general ownership of several parcels. As far as, would these roads go somewhere else or be used maybe by some of the other parcels to access development there? Or how might that tie together since we've heard that this property owner has about 700 acres, several parcels in that vicinity?
It is possible that this road could in the future connect to some of the other parcels. The adjacent parcels are under Williamson Act contract, most of them are. There is one parcel under Mr. Moore's ownership that's on Sea Canyon Road that is actually residential rural and rural lands designation, which is not under Williamson Act contract, and there are plans for development on that parcel. But that's not directly connected to this site, and that has actually frontage on Sea Canyon Road, so there's a direct connection there.
Okay, so that project is happening, but under a separate permitting process.
Right.
Okay. Trees? I see a condition, I thought, saying no trees to be removed, and then there's the mitigation of 2-to-1 and 4-to-1 for impacts and removal.
ND referenced the possible impact to about 15 trees and possible removal of 6. We're not sure quite yet exactly how many trees are going to be removed and impacted. Additionally, we'll want to take a look at what we assume was impacted or removed as part of the road and mitigate for that as well.
Was I imagining no trees to be removed in the conditions? Or to be removed in the conditions somewhere?
I might take another look at
I
that.
I thought there was just a bit of a conflict between the NP saying a few would have to be, and I thought I saw a condition saying none would be, but maybe I'm...
I'll take another look. We typically have a condition that says no trees other than those that are shown on the mitigation plan shall be removed.
Okay.
But I'll take another look and see if...
Okay, so from your understanding then, that would allow 6 to be removed and whatever it says, 15 to be impacted?
That's my understanding, yeah.
Okay, maybe we can talk about that more later, because I thought it was maybe a little more vague as far as how many would be with the road, with the CAL FIRE's requirements of the road set right away. Or
we'll take a look at the tree condition when we bring it back for action.
Yeah. That's my list for now.
Okay.
Thanks.
Commissioner White?
I just had one clarification question. Mr. Conger, you mentioned the road to be restored. I think I know what that means. Does that mean the road goes away and just restore it to its natural state?
As much as is feasible. A lot of this depends on the soil conditions. They may not be able to fully restore it to the original contours, but there would be certainly replanting occurring.
And then that leads to my last question is that because the road's not needed or...
That's correct. Originally, the plans were to have the water tanks at the end of that road.
Rains as a result from the enforcement action on
I'm not sure on this one. I could look into that
okay.
as well.
Maybe during the break you can make a quick call over there. And then that was a very illustrative aerial photo that you showed of the site that showed the entirety of the illegal grading. Do you have any before photos that shows what the resources were prior to the grading? Does Google Earth, you know?
I could try to pull up our 2003 aerial,
okay.
Which I believe was prior to that grading.
I think it would be useful to see if there were any trees or what the...
For the most part, where the building pads are located, that was non-native grasses.
Okay.
For the most part.
And
were some scrub species, I believe.
You verified that through checking older aerials?
That's correct.
Okay. And then, what is a pool structure?
We don't have a term pool structure in our ordinance. That was a term that was provided on the project plans.
What's your understanding of what a pool structure is?
Well, what we were considering it for the purposes of analysis for consistency with the ordinance is to have two components, a workshop and a guest house. And they are physically connected, but there's no internal connection. You have to go outside of the guest house to get into the workshop.
Component. Is there a swimming pool?
There's a pool adjacent to it.
Okay. So is this like a covered... is the pool, I was assuming, was referring to the swimming pool. But you're saying you're pooling the structures?
No.
No, this is like a pool house. People would refer to this as a pool house.
You know, there's changing rooms, and it's, you know, there's porticos and some place to stand
okay.
and when it starts lightning.
Okay, so it's like a little gazebo.
Well, it's actually... it has a sod roof, and it's built into the hillside. So... from the perspective of analyzing for height consistency, it's technically only 2 feet high as measured from average natural grade. It's like a daylight basement with no structure on top of it.
Okay, because it seemed kind of large for a changing room. But
the changing room is only
envisioning it.
There's a workshop that's disconnected from the changing room. But we're considering the changing room to be part of the workshop use.
But what does a workshop have to do with a swimming pool?
I'm not certain what the specific use of that would be, and that's something that we could direct to the applicant.
And then the ordinance prohibits a kitchen in a guest house, correct? But there's an outdoor kitchen, so the kitchen isn't in the guest house. So I'm assuming that the prohibition against the kitchen in the guest house has some policy reasoning behind it.
The kitchen is the thing that divides a guest house from a secondary residence.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a kitchen, you're a secondary residence. If you don't, you're a guest house. So that's why kitchens are not allowed in the guest house. And they've already got 2 residences proposed on this site, so they wouldn't qualify for any additional residences. We do routinely allow outdoor kitchens to be part of a workshop use. And what we've done as a policy is generally require that it be open to the elements, and in this case it's open to the elements on 2 sides. It's roofed, and it has a retaining wall on one side and a structure on one side, but 2 sides are open.
How difficult would it be to go in after the fact and close out those 2 sides?
Probably not terribly difficult.
Okay. And then I had the page open, and now, oh, there, I went right back to it. On page 2-6, at the top of the page, the third bullet under location, and it says, the guest house may be located no closer than 50 feet from a primary residence.
That's the one you changed.
Oh, we changed that one already. Okay. So that's been dealt with.
That's a report.
Okay. And then my last question is where does the export go? The exported material, where does that go?
It's really difficult to define an exportation site because a lot of it depends on what other projects are occurring at that time that require the importation of fill. In our analysis, I believe we considered exportation within a 5 or 10 mile radius, I don't recall which. And if no site is available to export to, they'd be able to export to Cold Canyon Landfill. So our typical procedure is to verify, before we issue a permit, a grading permit that would involve exportation of material, we need to verify that that has a home and that the destination site is legally permitted to receive that amount of material.
Okay.
But it's very difficult to do it up front in the environmental process because we don't know at which time they're going to be doing which structures. We don't know, what sites are going to be available to take the material.
Right, okay. Okay.
Can I just chime in there?
Sure.
How many truckloads is that, 15,000 cubic feet?
As a rule of thumb, we say a truck is going to be between 9 and 18 cubic yards. I'd have to do the math, but
so
dividing it by 10,
divided
you get about 1,500 truck trips.
1,500 truck trips of stuff coming off-site.
I mean, and that's on the high end. If they use the double trailers, it would be about half that amount.
So conservatively low would be 750 truck trips coming off-site.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. We're 15 minutes past our morning break time.
The architecture located here in San Luis Obispo. We are the architect of record with regard to the development before you this morning. I have with me the consultants that participated and contributed to the numerous studies that are part of your staff report this morning. I have Wendy Fisher, the environmental consultant from LSA, on any questions you might have with regard to that review. I have Mr. Harry Hamilton, the civil engineer from Above Grade Engineering, who developed the grading and drainage plans with regard to the proposed improvements. I thought in the interest of time that I would start by going through what questions some staff members had, what some commissioners had of staff that maybe I could clarify, and then I'd like to get into the staff report, Madam Chair. Just some clarifications and kind of get more information out there so you can render judgment this morning. The illegal grading is something that nobody, as long as we've lived in this county and done anything, this is something that's appalling and we don't endorse it, and it's something that is regretful that it occurred. There are some other reasonings to it. I want to get that out on the table, specifically that The initial illegal grading started with just post-purchasing of the property by the applicant, and he did not create a new road. He was essentially going in there to clear that road, clean the swales out so that it could actually operate better and he can acquire access. And it wasn't just up to that caretaker's unit. That road did, in fact, continue all the way up to the very top where that shed area is, or right at the base of it, specifically at that pad area that was on the second part of the illegal grading. And I might add that existing pad that was used had been permitted prior to this. He had purchased the property with a permit ready to issue. Fees hadn't been paid. That just wasn't going to work to his program. Hence, we stepped in to redesign the project. But a component of that second portion of the grading had already been graded. So again, there was the concern that this was all grading done in a manner that had or had been conducted in an area that hadn't been graded before was not true. Just wanted to put that into perspective. The issue with regard to the drainage on the adjacent property, we're just as concerned about it and certainly are in agreement to the added condition number 11 and its wording. To our best of knowledge, our engineer went out and met with Mr. George, the property owner on that property, and we could not find any historical drainage that contributed to that. This is a geologically sensitive area. It is a highly sensitive slide area. We had a very difficult time locating improvements. We had to work within the overlay of the entire 103 acreage to actually find a location for these improvements based on that. A lot of historical damage or historical earth movement based on that slight condition. And it's something that I think all the properties in that area, not just this, have some resolve with. To get to some of the concerns you had on some of the improvements, one specifically, Madam Chair, I believe you had with the laundry use in the pool house. Again, the only reason that was put in there was to accommodate a need to generate the ability to have a laundry facility available for towels and swimsuits. That was the only reason. There is no intent by this applicant to convert that building or that pool house to any other use than its intended use. The workshop is a hobby room. And it is a designated dirty area where hobbies can occur. I might add, that building is a very sustainable building. I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at the architectural design. It has a vegetated roof that is an extension of the dig-in component so that it has less impact visually on the scale of this development. It has a lot of sustainable reuse issues with it. It also has a solar array for the heating of not only the pool water, but the domestic water with regard to the use on the house. So we're trying to do what we can to have, you know, as little impact on the scale of that built-out portion. On the water usage, I think that was a numerical error. It is actually a 0.2, not a 0.02. I might also add that it's not based on number of bathrooms. It's actually based on number of bedrooms, which is the equivalent to the occupancy. It's the same with a waste disposal methodology. There's four bedrooms in this house. So I don't know that that's any different, in our opinion, than what a normal four-bedroom house would have. The scale of this house is based on the ancillary spaces, large community, family room, large kitchen. He likes to entertain. He has that component for use in the size of the house. With regard to tree removal, we have no intent to remove any trees. The impact of any trees that may be removed is in the portion of the improved road that is right adjacent to the caretaker's home or the caretaker's trailer was that existing building pad. And he had every intent to install an orchard area there. He has a business license to perform agricultural work and planting on site, and that was the intent of that second illegal grading. He did consult with the county prior to doing this. The information he got, he felt he was compliant to, and at the time of implementing it, that's when it went bad. And the grading contractor exceeded that minimum standard. Hence, that was the issue, and that's why it was overgraded or graded to a greater extent. The only other thing I'd like to do at this time, Madam Chair, I only have a couple minutes left to just go through the staff report real quickly.
what I would just like to go to is on your page 2-6 with regard to the garage workshop. There's mentioned that staff is recommending no bathrooms be located on the second floor as conditioned, and recommending the kitchenette facilities not be included in the workshop. This is a working barn. A lot of agricultural businesses either have portable toilets and don't provide any cooking areas or areas for any use by workers. We're trying to facilitate that here. It's a workshop. It is not going to be converted to a residence or a dwelling. I think there's other ways we can deal with this. We can either apply a covenant. We can have a enforcement visit this on a yearly basis, every 6 months, to ensure that it doesn't happen. The use is important to the applicant. He's expressed the need to have that, but there is absolutely no intent to do anything other than what we're proposing by design. The only other thing that I wanted to get into on the staff report think that might have been all I had that was of anything on my end. Yeah, that's it on everything with my end. Again, emphasizing that the grading on the front end with the road grading, the initial grading, that road was in place. It was not a new road or graded as a result otherwise. I have no other comments or responses to your questions. I hope I got all of them. If I didn't, let me know. Other than that, my client is willing to accept the conditions of approval and hopefully get your approval for the conditional use permit this morning. Again, if you have any questions of me, I'd be more than glad to do my best. And again, I have the avail of my consultants, the environmental consultant and the civil engineer available should you have any questions regarding their scope of work.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there any questions for the applicant's agent at this time, starting with the commissioner from the district?
Hi. Thank you very much. I just have one question, kind of a follow-up to what I was talking about before. I'm not really sure about an outdoor kitchen that's over 1,000 square feet. I don't really, I was thinking more like of a barbecue grill kind of thing, and I didn't really look at the square footage until we got here, and I'm not quite sure what's going to be in a thousand foot outdoor kitchen.
You know, if he would like to have an outdoor kitchen, it's something, again, he entertains. I think if there was a size that was more comfortable to the commission, I'm willing to consider it, or if there's something, Carolyn, that you feel otherwise, let's put it into the conditions to get it where you think it's appropriate. I can't speak to some degree for the motivation of his design program, other than how he likes to do things and use things. And that's what I responded to.
Sure.
Architects go through programming, and programming necessitates scope and scale. And we have the area to facilitate it. We didn't see any land use issues. We certainly aren't expecting, and in no way would we endorse any conversion of that to any other use other than what we're proposing. So,
again, just to get into the details of it, I live in a house that's 925 square feet, so I'm putting a grill on one side and then like 500 feet away. I just don't understand what is in a 1,000 square foot kitchen.
I can explain a little bit of it.
Is that a kitchen floor or a picnic table or what?
A combination of all of the above. And you know, a lot of times when you get into what they call a catering kitchen, that's exactly it. It takes a larger. It's not just preparatory work. I can't speak to the absolute specifics, but he does entertain. He does intend to cater events. Will he need it? I'm not sure if he needs 1,000 or if he could get by with 500. You know, it's the intent by program that was given to us. We saw that we could facilitate it and make it work, and we did our best.
Okay,
Mr. Carlin, if I could just cut in for 1 second on that. If he intends to cater, he's going to need a professional kitchen,
right.
And I can't imagine that the health department would certify an outdoor
I'm not suggesting he is going to cater, but he would have catered, meaning catered food or pre-prepared food area, actually. In some cases, you know, we would have, as you typically would see, a power pole with a riser. It's the line coming down and then going underground into the dwelling or the structure that it's providing the power for. I believe that was what we felt to be the intent of any utility
overhead and two underground design.
Because I understood it, the area standard calls for it, but we're making an exception here because of the distance.
Exactly,
from,
right.
The large parcel
to,
size.
To go that whole distance all the way back to the location of the proposed residence would be quite a bit of area to cover, and it would be financially difficult. And again, it is allowed to be overhead, and we would do it in that manner.
Commissioner White, questions for the applicant's agent?
Yes, Mr. Smith, you mentioned the barn would be a working barn. And you also mentioned an orchard. Is there plans for an agricultural operation here?
Yes, there is. Our client has put in place a business, I believe an LLC, with regard to in the area that would be adjacent to or to the east of the primary residence is a area that he's thinking of dealing with or proposing a future orchard area, citrus-related type fruit. And so the area of locating that barn, if you would, or that equipment area, was based on where we could put structures. Again, this is a geological overlay. We can't put buildings at the toe of any slide or at the top of any slide area. In the geological report that was prepared, there's some, the most of the site is in a slide overlay. It's
very difficult.
I understand
you had to limit your siding to the...
Right. So the fact that that equipment barn is located where it is facilitates the one of the only approved sites that we could locate any other additional built structure, and it had access or was closer to the primary gate to get out and get off site. So that was another reason for that. But it is to be an operating business, and that was the intent of having that bathroom and having some area again as a, I call it a kitchenette. It certainly would be a combination of work or an area for a sink area is all we're really proposing with a counter. Certainly wasn't going to be any full-blown kitchen by any means.
Yeah, I guess the issue is that we're being, staff is proposing to strike that bathroom upstairs of that barn workshop, and there is a bathroom on the downstairs area. So do you envision the upstairs as being a break room for the workers or a
combination break room, admin space, and I believe the one upstairs actually had a shower. He wanted to have one of them to have a shower. And that's, again, was in the program with regard to having a restroom with a shower on that second level.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Melskow, any questions?
Not right now.
I don't have any questions at this time.
Okay. All right.
Thank you for your testimony.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Did staff have anything to add at this point? We had a few questions before we went to break.
Yes, I had three questions I wrote down. The first one was regarding fines, and we did take a look. It looks like this project was being assessed $3,218 in violation fees associated with the as-built grading permit. And the second question was with regards to water. We ran the calculations again, and it looks like the indoor water use should be 0.17 acre-feet per year when considering both structures, and not 0.02 as previously noted. So that would bring the total acre-feet per year to 1.19 when including the outdoor. And then the third item was in regards to an aerial image from before the project site was graded, and if I can get that put on the screen. And this aerial was taken in the summer of 2003. This is roughly where the single-family residence would be going. And for comparison, I can flip back over to the code enforcement photo, and you can see these areas with oak vegetation were not disturbed.
Can you flip back then, so now we have a reference? Okay. So what we had just heard in the from the applicant's agent was that that grading pad area had actually already been graded, but I don't see evidence of that in this
I took
area.
A quick look at the permit history, and we did have a permit around 2002 that was applied for to put a single-family residence on this site, and it was listed as minor grading to go along with that single-family residence. And that permit was processed but never issued.
Okay. So no grading, it doesn't look from either the history or from the aerial that any grading actually took place.
The only grading...
Consistent with the permit.
The only grading permit that we had in the file was for access to the manufactured residence, which is downhill from here. And that was just...
So I don't know. I can't really...
It looks to me like it might be part of a little sort of patchy seasonal wetland complex that runs up to the sort of upper corner of our screen.
Yeah. Oh, I see, yes.
Yeah.
Up to the right there, above the road.
A bit of a drainage there.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Conger, for getting the answers to those questions so quickly during your break. Okay, Commissioner Christensen, like you said, this is your backyard.
Yes, well, Commissioner Wyatt, since you want to have some discussions about various aspects of this project, and there certainly are a couple of areas that you can... I'm going to start off with the most obvious one, which is the fact that the staff is recommending no bathrooms in the and no kitchen on the second floor. We've got something called a pool structure, which we're not sure it is. That is outdoor kitchen, which is sitting there. So, anyway, so what's the discussion? I just say right out, I'm basically supportive of staff's recommendation that no bathrooms or
well, if we could proceed like that, if you want to go through kind of issue by issue, I wondered. I was kind of anticipating that there would be some sort of kind of macro overview of your general impression of the project, but you want to get right down
to
the mission.
Well, I think all of us are, we've all been on this mission now for a year, and we've all seen, as-built applications. Unpermitted grading, and we are not happy with that kind of stuff. But given that, we do have a project in front of us. I'm not really happy with the size of this project, but again, there's no law against it. So I'm going to go through with what we've got.
I'd like to just throw out maybe a counter view or a subsequent view, and I don't know that there'll be support for this, but I have long been a proponent when we have after-the-fact permits for code violations that are egregious in nature. Just philosophically, I think that it's a better policy direction to go to have applicants rectify their violations first. Fix the violation to everyone's satisfaction, and then come in with a clean slate for your project permit. Because when we're in a situation like this, what we're being told is we can't fix the problem. We can't restore the roads, we can't restore the wetlands, we can't install the culverts, we can't do any of that unless we approve some level of development along with it. And this project got fined $3,000. That was probably less than one day of the heavy equipment operator to do the work, which I'm sure took many, many days. And that's just not really, in my mind, much in the way of a deterrence. I know the grading ordinance that we just sent to the Board of Supervisors is going to hopefully, certainly designed and intended to stop a lot of these kinds of activities. But with respect to what's before us today, I'm interested to see if the commissioners have any interest in simply authorizing the remediation of the site as the extent of this permit. How do people feel about that?
Well,
I might look to council, but I believe your commission does have the discretion to change what would be proposed under the project description.
I think you have that discretion.
Yeah, following up on that, I'm troubled by this because
here we come. We see a vast extent of illegal grading. What's the trigger in our new grading ordinance for a permit, 50 cubic yards of fill?
I'm sorry, could you ask that question?
What's the trigger in our new grading permit for a in our grading ordinance for a permit, 50 cubic yards?
50 cubic yards is correct.
And what are we looking at here?
The as-built work, I believe, was about 10,000 cubic yards of cut and 10,000 cubic yards of fill.
So 10,000 by 50 is
many times.
A lot.
We add the cut and the fill, so that would technically be 20,000.
Okay, so we're many times over trigger.
I have a clarification on that, but Mr. Conger, we just heard testimony from Mr. Smith that a lot of this was done prior to their ownership. Is this an addition to what was done prior?
Well, right, and we hear that, and that's a recurring theme as well. Well, it was the guy before me. And I know that's a difficult one because maybe people get into this unknowing, but it is very difficult. And if we're all serious about deterring this kind of behavior, allowing 22,000 square feet of development, maybe without a kitchenette and one of the bathrooms proposed, isn't really a very effective way to deter future behavior.
You know, when we did go through the grading ordinance, you know, I argued extensively, and I appreciate the commission's efforts in achieving some educational goals and outreach mm-hmm. to the tractor operators. And I've had no previous discussion with Mr. Smith on this issue, and he testified here today. What I repetitively said during those hearings is that the tractor operators are out there telling people, you don't have to do anything, you're exempt. And they're overreaching and overdoing it. So, you know, I don't know how to balance the culpability of this current applicant with the operators being involved and what was done previously. So it's difficult for me to sit here and be punitive towards this applicant when I'm not real certain how much he's responsible for.
Well, the way I look at it is the enforcement division, and maybe it would be helpful if we had somebody from enforcement here. If it comes to that, maybe we want to continue this till after lunch. But enforcement has taken an action. They have determined that a violation has taken place. They have assessed a fine. I mean, they've made those findings and made that determination based on their records. And so I'm certainly not suggesting this commission should, you know, second guess, you know, whether or not a violation has taken place there. The remediations in this permit, Mr. Conger, if I'm not mistaken, are the remediations that are being suggested by the enforcement division or not? Does enforcement suggest what needs to be done to put it right?
Not typically. It's usually what comes out of the environmental review process,
okay.
And I think some of this came out of the biological report.
Okay.
You know, that was my question. I didn't see a report from code enforcement. I don't know if they prepare like an investigative report, because what we heard here, there is a violation. I'm not disputing mm-hmm. that, but the testimony we got from Mr. Smith was that it was, intended to clean up the existing previous violations. So that's what I'm not certain how much of this, again, it was done by the applicant.
Right. There's no report that's filed by the code enforcement officer. They do file a notice of violation or provide that to the applicant, and in that letter they explain what they need to do to comply with the ordinance, and in this case it's apply for a grading permit and apply for a conditional use permit, which they subsequently did. So that's the extent of what the code enforcement officers would do.
Well, we did, when we had that, of the violation, it was in the coastal zone in Los Osos. Is it Little Morro Creek?
It was the Lee Project.
Right. But this is exactly what we did in the Lee Project. We issued a conditional use permit that authorized the restoration of the site. And so, whether the current applicant did what percentage of the grading versus what was already there, whether the bulldozer driver was following directions from the applicant or whether he went off on some wild tangent. Point is, there is restoration that's been identified that's required to rectify the violation. And I'm just suggesting that that's what we authorized today.
I have a question for Mr. Conger. You know how I can phrase this. To accomplish the best job, would that cause any problems or issues if this was all done in two phases rather than being done at one time? Sometimes when you try to do what's being suggested, you can do some damage that if you were able to do it all together, that you can control it a little bit better.
Well, the question I would have is if you were to pursue the restoration option, would you also be looking to have the building pad areas restored to their original state as well? In which case, I would suggest against that, because that would be disturbing that area, then coming back in and disturbing that area again. And from a water quality perspective, we'd rather see that disturbed only one time and have an opportunity to revegetate.
That's the answer I was looking for, because I'm concerned that if we go down this road of restoration only, that we could end up, you know, potentially creating more damage. So I don't know how to separate or balance that.
We would have to work that if that's a direction that we see ourselves willing to go to. And I think it's a logical one, and that was our intent with putting the 5-year hold in the new grading ordinance.
I hear that with a jaundiced ear, quite frankly. But if that is indeed the case, then the appropriate action there is to take, you know, the civil action against the operator. And
yes, there's two points there. That one is that the bulldozer's operator went beyond the direction it was given. But the other more important point, I think, is that the testimony is, and the aerial showed, as Mr. Conger said, the roads were there prior to the ownership by this applicant. So, again, without knowing how to weigh all these things and balance who did what and how much of that, irregardless of what the bulldozer did under the direction of the current applicant, it's difficult for me to, you know, I didn't take that position with Mr. Lee, so
right.
I certainly can't take
right.
it here where Mr. Lee took full responsibility.
Eugene, I see you sort of nodding with Commissioner White's comments. Do you have anything to add?
Not really. But also, you're comparing the amount of cut and fill compared to the new ordinance, which is not law yet. So, I mean, 50 isn't law yet.
I agree, and so I'm not trying to invoke that here. I'm just trying to use it for compare.
I know, but you're using it for comparison, something that's not law yet.
Mr. Conger, did you have something you wanted to add?
I did also want to point out, not only did your commission consider the Lee project this year, there was another conditional use permit for as-built grading that was considered in April. That was for a project in Creston, and in that case, it was also a single-family residence that was being proposed, and your commission did not require that applicant to restore before the single-family residence was to be constructed.
And I might note, I was not in attendance at that hearing.
Well, I like the idea that Commissioners Wyatt and Christy are proposing, but I think in this situation I'm going to go with Commissioner White and not support a two-phase application. And it is tempting, but I can't see it. My memory is much worse than everybody else's in this room. But there was something about the Lee application that was different.
Conservation easement.
It was different. It felt like in that situation the requirement to come back for the actual project was reasonable. Whereas in the one we did in Creston, we did not require that. And I think in this one, it's certainly a reasonable thing to do. But I don't really think I'm going to make this applicant the example of what we're moving to after hopefully our board approves the changes we made in the grading ordinance. Again, it's tempting. I mean, it's really tempting. But I really just feel like it's a different situation here. And again, the actual before photo makes me more inclined to go in that direction because I think that the fact that there was quite a bit of grading when this applicant took possession is different than basically just plowing new roads right next to creek beds all the way through up to property, which is what happened in the Lee situation, as I remember.
Could I just ask, though, in there, what the difference is if you purchase property where you have some code violations and illegal kind of activities having happened, what responsibility then does the new owner bear?
From the county's perspective, if you're purchasing a property with violations, you're also purchasing those violations, mm-hmm. and the landowner is still responsible to resolve any issues.
And that's, I mean, that's, well, that's why we're imposing the requirement to fix those violations now, that I think in the sense of a punitive action, you may not, you know, it would be extremely punitive to have them do it in a two-phase thing, and I think in that situation I'm not so willing to apply that extra layer of effort. I think we're going to be doing other things to the actual project.
Okay, well, let's start working through those conditions then.
Yeah.
I just had to put it out there.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I do think it was a good discussion to have. Okay, so.
Actual conditions?
Kitchenette, bathroom, workshop, yes, no.
My question on that is, what's typical for an agricultural operation? And if it is necessary, not, I don't know that it is, but if it is necessary, that it could be conditioned only when there's a verified agricultural operation on site.
Yeah,
I'm just going to say, I don't view this as an agricultural operation.
Yeah.
Enforcement found it was not an agricultural operation. They didn't buy that argument. And just because you've formed an LLC on the neighboring property, to me, when you get around to planting your oranges and you need to have that equipment, then you can build yourself an ag storage facility, and I think that's the appropriate timing. But to put all these structures in and say, oh, it's for the agricultural use we're going to do sometime later with all these, you know, bathrooms and showers and kitchens, I'm just reluctant.
Yeah, I'm just willing to go.
While we discuss this, could we put the table on of proposed development of the various structures?
I'm just also willing to go along with what staff sees and what staff recommends, and that's where they're at with it, and also that's where I am too. I could see that maybe there might be some ag development later on, but you have a 10,000 square foot house with 1,000 foot outdoor kitchens. He has a wonderful place to entertain friends and have house guests and everything, but they shouldn't be putting, you know, basically what could become residential amenities into, you know, hobby rooms.
Yeah.
So
are you okay with those structures?
Well, we'll talk about that separately, but in terms of kitchen, that's one of the conditions, it's one of the staff recommendations. I just wanted to get that clear, that I was going to support that condition.
I'm not arguing this.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong here. I'm just, for the sake of freedom, you know, the applicant to be able to do what within the boundaries of what's acceptable on their own property, I just wanted to look at it a little bit to see if there's a real necessity the way it was presented, and I don't know that there is, if before we just condition it where it could never happen in perpetuity, if there's a way.
Valid points, and, you know, and if there's one I agree with, I'll say.
But I do have a clarification question on that from staff. If we condition this, is it in perpetuity, or could the applicant come in at a later date where they obviously show a real need for this and get a permit to do this, or would it kill that in perpetuity to have this condition?
They'd have to request a modification to the condition and go back through the conditional use permit process.
Well, it could be changed.
Yeah.
Quite an expense.
If we can afford to build a 10,000 square foot house and a how many thousand square foot pool structure, you know, I mean, he can afford to pick the conditional use permit fees, in my opinion.
I'm just comfortable with staff's evaluation of it, so that's where I'm going to stay.
Okay.
So we have laundry facilities and a pool room, pool structure, with an outdoor kitchen, a workshop of 1,500, an outdoor kitchen of 1,000, a guest house of 592 square feet, a changing room, mechanical room, and covered patio, and laundry facilities. So do we want to modify any of this? And if so, why? You tell me.
Well, because the kitchen's bigger than your house.
You know, starters, it's very tempting to use your own personal values to evaluate projects, and it really is. But I don't do that. And I just was trying to point out to the applicant that I could not imagine a kitchen that big, even in, you know, I mean, I've lived in many big, very beautifully appointed houses. Just because I prefer not to anymore doesn't mean anything in terms of what's appropriate. I just could not understand why in every very nicely appointed house I've been in, why you'd have a kitchen that large, and even an outdoor kitchen with a grill and you know, the side range and the storage, you know, the refrigerator, whatever you put out there, to do that kind of entertaining. It just seemed excessively large, you know, in terms of a kitchen. it seemed to me that that would be part of like a patio as opposed to the kitchen. So that's why I was using my house as an example. I'm just trying to, illustrate is I know how big that is. It's a very big place for a kitchen.
Okay, so I want to agree with you there that that's a large space, but also trying to separate my values or judgment on what's reasonable and what's allowed, because
right.
This kitchen is about as big as my house, but also, yeah, that
right.
my issue having this outdoor kitchen and this laundry combined with the guest house is this seems to me a rather obvious circumvention of the very strict requirement that a guest house not have a kitchen and laundry. So my issue here is that consolidating these things in one structure just literally circumvents the rule here,
yeah.
That those aren't
yeah.
within this structure. So I would say either the laundry and the kitchen go, or the guest house goes, or they somehow be separated in structure. To allow these in the same structure is like saying, okay, you can have a third residence, we're fine
right.
with it. Because that's what it is,
right.
for all intensive purposes,
right.
whether the kitchen has four walls or two walls. So that's my issue, and I would suggest that we all make one go away. And whichever one it is fine with me, because I'm all for an allowance of a guest house. But I would suggest the proposal for these various kitchenettes and sinks, and there's plumbing in the existing shed, suggests that there are other ways to have a guest house that are possibly already being used. So, which would it be? Kitchen and laundry and the pool house goes
well, my
the
theory,
guest house goes
my approach would be not to allow the laundry facilities. And I don't really understand, when someone builds a house and they want to have an outdoor grill area, does that need to be permitted, the outdoor grill?
No.
I mean, so it would be, you know, so that's the part that, you know, that just needs to be changed to what it really is. Or
well, you can eliminate the outdoor kitchen.
Yes.
And you can still have a patio area with a grill, and it can have a little, you know, awning over it or cover or whatever. But, you know,
yeah.
an outdoor kitchen to me, that has, like, built-in features and cupboards and, you know,
I don't really understand that term. It's kind of like the idea of a pool structure. What, you know, an outdoor kitchen is to be a kitchen. Well, that's the kitchen
yeah.
then. So, I guess I'm saying, you know, I'd be going for the no laundry and kitchen. And
right. And keep the guest house portion
house.
Of it if that's the
yes.
desire of the applicant, or the other way.
I would go along with
what,
that.
How is that then?
Well,
I'm
really not trying to argue here, but I continually find myself on the other end of these things. You know, I agree with Commissioner Christensen's comment that it's not left to us to regulate other people's lifestyles. And I have experienced a situation like this before. Many, many years ago, I was doing, not that I have friends that can afford something like this, but I was doing some volunteer work in the Los Angeles area for some inner city youth, the intent of a guest house. But if this was an outdoor type pool entertainment facility, Mr. Smith, I think, offered up that we could, you know, he would take a condition to annually inspect it or send in video or a picture or something that this thing isn't being enclosed and used as part of the guest house.
But if it's a pool facility, let's make it a pool facility. If they want the large outdoor kitchen for entertaining, okay, I'm not suggesting we don't allow that. But then I am suggesting we shouldn't allow it attached. It's not detached. It shares a wall with this structure here. As I see it, there's a shared wall, and I heard there was a retaining wall on one side.
Well, the way I understood our staff report, and I understand what you're saying, the way the floor plan looks here, but the staff report said it was on the exterior of the structure.
Well, because it had two open sides.
And I suppose the architect could go in and split the guest house portion and have a pool facility and a guest house facility. I don't know if that's something they're willing to do, but just, you know, seriously, I mean, this is a 10,000-square-foot beautiful estate. You know, whether that's our lifestyle or not, I just don't know if we're in our...
It's not our lifestyle.
We're not making that. It's against
our
code.
I understand what you're saying, but
according to
staff, it's not.
The code said, well, but that's staff's recommendation. We're the decision makers here. And the code says you can't have kitchen and laundry in a guest house. So our question is, does that mean you can't have kitchen and laundry inside the four walls of the guest house? Because if that's the case, then we're going to see future applications for guest houses with outdoor kitchens, which will then which will then be used as third residences that they wouldn't otherwise qualify for. And so, regardless of whether or not it is the applicant's stated intent to use this area strictly for entertaining, we have a fundamental policy question before us about what does that ordinance mean when it says a guest house can't have kitchen and laundry. And my inclination is that it means you can't have kitchen and laundry inside the house or outside the house.
Well,
you can't have a kitchen.
Well, let me pose this question then. What would it take to satisfy this as meeting those requirements? Would it take a breezeway between the guests? Because they have to walk outside of the guest quarters to get into the bathroom for the pool, the pool bathroom that contains the laundry. So if there was a 3-foot breezeway between
you could
there,
have an outdoor kitchen at the primary residence. At the 10,000 square foot house,
this is within 50 feet, and the pool is here, so it essentially is at the primary residence.
Right,
it's within 50 feet. We changed that to no further than 50 feet, so it's within the 50 feet range, and it's also adjacent to the pool. The way I understand it, it's really hard on the site plan to see all this, but Mr. Smith is nodding that it's adjacent to the pool. So, again, I'm not trying to be argumentative. I just understand what the applicant's trying to achieve here, and I know that it pushes the envelope of the intent, and I don't question that at all. But it technically meets the requirement because there is a dividing wall there that separates it. Now, if you want a setback or a physical separation,
I'm going to ask the applicant's agent to come up. And if you, Mr. Smith, I know you can't channel your applicant perfectly, but is your sense of the design, would the applicant rather have the pool and the outdoor kitchen and the laundry facilities without the guest house, or would your applicant rather have the guest house and the pool without the laundry and kitchen facilities? Which do you think would be more amenable?
Before I answer that, if I can just qualify one thing and taking it back one step, Madam Chair, and that is that, again, this consolidated design not only was the result of a design program, but of site constraints. We have a very small area that we can locate improvements, and again, that geological overlay can show you the slide areas. We're limited to a certain area. I would be very open to separating that outdoor kitchen as shown from the structure if that were a concern. I think Commissioner White brought up a point of a breezeway or some separation to distinguishably take it away from any association to that, and it operates then just as a kitchen without any connection. I'd be all for it. I have to find a place on site to do that, though, and that is a constraint, that is an issue. I can make that, as I mentioned to Commissioner Christensen, I can make that kitchen smaller if that's something that is by purview. Again, I'm going based on his program, the criteria he gave me. If I have to make a choice, it would be the latter, to lose the laundry and separate the kitchen. He needs that guest house. So that again, was...
The latter wasn't lose the laundry and separate...
It was Beverly Hills' intention. It's not to have another family living in this home right here. It's Beverly Hills that I experienced. It's to have a nice entertainment area, and when people come up or out from out of the area, they have a nice place to stay, but they're not going to be living there on a full-time basis. And I think the intent of the kitchen and the guest house, so the guest house doesn't become a secondary dwelling.
I'm just sorry, but 10,000 square foot house is a place to stay. Then if there are constraints,
Well, that's not a necessity for this person. But that's not for us to decide.
And if it meets the regulations and it's separated from the kitchen and the laundry, I'm okay with it. But we already have 1,500 truck trips of dirt coming out of here, and if it meets our requirements, I would be okay with it. But in the connected building, I just see that as a real stretch.
Madam Chair, if I could add something.
Mm-hmm.
The requirements for the guest houses are in Chapter 2230, and any standard Chapter 2230 can be waived or modified through a conditional use permit with the adoption of special findings that state that certain site constraints may make the standards unnecessary or ineffective. And so that's something your commission can also pursue.
Thank you for that.
And I would say if we had a moderate-sized house and we still couldn't find a great place for the guest house, I might be able to make those findings. But I can't make those findings if we've got space for 10,000 square foot of house. Then somehow we have space for some adjustments to have been made. And just because the applicant doesn't want to make them,
well, I'm interested in
we can't.
Figuring out what is in the, I can't see it, and I couldn't see it on my plans, but what is in, there it goes. I can understand the need for a entertainment. I mean, I do a lot of entertainment, too, here, and I'm using myself again, but that's okay. and having some kind of an, well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, an outdoor kitchen versus what I consider, it's, you know, grills and
two dishwashers and a wine cooler. And
yeah,
and two refrigerators.
You're 30 feet away from a main house.
And
it's
two
a big party.
Sinks.
Yeah,
it's a big party. It's true.
And I see how for an entertainment
okay, only
setting
I
that would be
to
useful.
Party.
I see how this would be useful from an entertainment standpoint.
Totally.
But I also see how that kind of crosses the line between connecting the guest house and being usable.
Well, in my mind, you know, it's not a factor of what's available in the primary house because,
yeah.
Again, those are lifestyle choices. We don't know what's going on in the primary house. Maybe it's full of children and they don't want to be disturbed by the party. So
yeah.
All the rowdy folks
I'm
out in the guest house. So.
More inclined to say no laundry room and somehow get this kitchen separated from this guest house is where I'm interested.
Madam Chair, we'd be willing to take that on in terms of a redesign to be hopefully approachable.
So is that a continuance then?
Madam Chair, I believe we could board a condition. If we do this during the lunch break, I believe we could come up with a condition or maybe even on the fly to address that.
Okay, because I think I want to stress, this is not a values or a lifestyle question. This is a fundamental interpretation of our ordinance question because, I'm going to say it again, if we go down the route of allowing outdoor kitchens for guest houses that don't allow kitchens, we're going to see a lot of them. And so if we're going to separate this kitchen out, I want to see where and how it's being separated. I don't want just some condition worded, you know, and hope that that's going to achieve the goal. I really want to see where it's going to go and how it's going to go.
In some ways, and I agree with that, but I want to just say in some ways, I mean, I am hearing Commissioner White, the fact that this is a huge outdoor kitchen facility actually almost does argue against the fact that it goes with the guest house because why would 552 but guest house need a kitchen this big. If you were doing serious outdoor entertaining, you know, very serious outdoor entertaining in a large scale, this, you know, it makes sense. It just is a little
okay.
Close to that guest.
Okay, so it sounds like that's going to come back after lunch.
Yeah.
In the next 15 minutes, can we go through some of the other conditions? And maybe
those are the two ones in the approved development in the under Exhibit B under the first condition. I just wanted those are those.
Okay.
Those
what
are
did
it.
We did we reach a conclusion on the laundry facilities?
Oh yeah, I say no laundry.
No laundry facilities. We're all good with that. Okay, so we're going to strike the laundry facility reference.
Commissioners, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can we note the condition numbers, each one,
oh,
while
certainly.
You're going through them?
I'm sorry about
but
that.
Number one, D.
But that's why I was a little confused then with the mitigation.
Well, mitigation is for impacts, perhaps.
Impacts and
but
I'm
they
not
did
sure
not remove. It did list removals, which made it seem like some removals.
If we determine that there was a removal from any of the grading activities, we'd like to be able to mitigate for that as well.
Okay, so having that in there then makes sense.
That would be a condition violation, however. Which would be another enforcement action, technically.
The grading activities that are
built
today.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay, it just since we're on that, though, it did sound like there were some questions as to whether trees would have to be removed per CAL FIRE requirements, that 10 feet would have to be cleared or something along the roads.
CAL FIRE typically doesn't require removal of oak trees, but they do require trimming, and we don't necessarily consider trimming to be an impact. We consider impacts if there are any site disturbance activities in the root zone.
Okay, so it would be limited to trimming. And that would kick in some kind of mitigation then, or not?
It wouldn't, unless it was also impacted by site work. And if they're trimming it probably has, the root zone probably would be impacted by road activity, because it's usually trimmed within 10 feet of a road or within 30 feet of a house. So it's possible that it's also impacted. But trimming does not constitute impacts.
Okay.
Before we go too far along, I see Mr. Smith at the podium. I don't know if you had a comment on 1D, maybe? Or
I just wanted to make comment, Madam Chair, that in the interest of getting approval today and not getting a continuance, my client just notified or indicated to me that he's willing to take out certain improvements. Namely, he is willing to remove the pool house altogether and the kitchen. I mean, we want to satisfy, obviously, the letter of the ordinance. We're not trying to be difficult here. We want to make it easier. But if that's something that would allow us to move on from today, we're open to that.
So is that, I mean, we weren't even contemplating that.
Yeah, we were
contemplating
that. Why don't we talk about that?
Well, and again, I'm going to the extreme to let you know how we're trying to be workable here. And, you know, I'm certainly, I guess I'm putting more on the plate for you to choose from or to alter. I'd like to keep as much on the plate as we can, but I don't want to make it such that it's anything that would trigger a continuum.
Well, if we did that, we wouldn't have to come back after lunch, so.
We still have item 3.
I know, but I mean, we would have to come back item after lunch.
My preference would be to take it out, because I think it's messy, and I think it's going to cause us more problems down the line.
I'm with you.
So I'd rather just not see it. If the house disappears and just in the workshop and just the outdoor kitchen, for example, if the applicant wants to entertain and wants just that outdoor kitchen.
I'm fine with it in the sense because
in the pool.
First of all, the applicants asked for agreed to it already, but also then if they want to come back and put something in there, they can come back with another application to put a different structure in.
Triggers the next question. Mr. Conger, would that require another conditional use permit to come in for an application for a pool house or pool facility guest house, or would that be a regular building permit?
I might look to Mr. Hogue, but I believe that Table 2-3 is a cumulative disturbance, so since they've already disturbed over 3 acres, any additional disturbance, my interpretation is that would be a conditional use permit.
You're looking to cut down the grading, too.
Yes,
exactly.
Okay,
Plus, they'd be asking for something that wasn't authorized here. I think they'd need a conditional use permit to do that.
So then, just to be clear, what we're contemplating is removing the guest house and the kitchen. And I see the applicant nodding in the affirmative.
I wish they would have told me before I fought so hard to hang on.
Madam Chair, mechanically, in terms of the conditions of approval, I believe that you could accomplish that if that's what the collective commission wants to do, by taking out condition 1D. Because it simply would not include any reference to authorizing the pool structure, the guest room, the outdoor kitchen. That's where all that is referenced.
So instead of adding no laundry, we're just going to take it out altogether.
Take out 1D altogether.
Can I clarify, because there is a workshop component that wasn't discussed. Would we be keeping the workshop component of that structure in or removing that structure altogether?
Yeah. It was one structure, so...
He's going to take it out.
And he's not... The applicant's agent is nodding in the affirmative.
The entire structure would be deleted.
Except the pool, then, itself.
Right. We would keep the pool.
Okay, so then we're just going to strike 1D altogether. Well, that's simple.
Thank you.
Are we done?
Yeah.
I think we're done.
I've never seen that.
Well, that's easy. Well, that was easy.
That's easy, yeah.
I entertain a motion.
I do, before we move on to a motion, I thank the applicant's representative for that. That makes it, that lessens the impact. Again, a huge amount of grading here, 1,500 truck loads of stuff. We don't have it here, so I'm not going to invoke that or try to set some limits, but I hope we can see that ahead in the near future.
And other communities are taking
You're forcing me to respond to that.
Okay.
No,
get a motion on the table. Let me just do a motion. I'll respond saying that talking about that kind of thing probably like talking about healthcare, and I'm in healthcare, and we don't want to talk about another issue like that. That's a
good issue for the workshop next year.
Yeah, it's a reasonable question. It's a reasonable comment, but it really there's a lot of very strong and different opinions about that aren't necessarily. I don't know if we can even come up to. I know we couldn't even come up to an agreement among this commission, much less in this community. But I think it's certainly a valid conversational discussion topic for our county as a whole. For this commission right now, no. Right now we're going to do a motion. and so I would like to make a motion that we adopt the NAG DEC in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section 21,000 et sec, and approve the conditional use permit DRC 2007-00011 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified. We eliminated number 20 and then renumbered after that. We eliminated number 11. We modified number 11 as presented by staff, and we eliminated number 1D, referring to the pool structure as an approved part of the development.
I'll second.
Been moved by Commissioner Christensen and seconded by Commissioner White. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Yes.
Commissioner Mielsko?
Yes.
Chairperson Christie?
Yes. The permit is approved. Okay, we're going to break for lunch now. We'll return at 1:30 and take up our third hearing item of the day at that time. See you all. Okay, we're going to call the December 10th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission back to order. Ms. Hedges, would you please announce the next hearing item for us?
Hearing to consider a request by Colin Weirich for a conditional use permit. County file number DRC 2007-00024, Supervisorial District Number 1, John Nall and Shauna Scott, Project Managers.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I'm John Nall. I'm your Principal Environmental Specialist. The team before you for this last item of the day consists of Elizabeth Cavanaugh of our own planning staff, and making the presentation this afternoon is going to be Shauna Scott, a local consultant with SWCA. And I'll turn it over to Shauna.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman and members of the Commission. I'm Shauna Scott, SWCA. Today before you is a request for a conditional use permit by Colin Weirich.
Oh, thanks for a moment.
Thank you. The request includes an as-built portion. It's an as-built lumber and landscaping material yard, including paving, storage of materials, and landscaping, and 50 parking spaces. Additional proposed structures include 10 pole barns to store and screen materials, including one 14,000 square foot, six 6,000 square foot, and three 5,300 square feet in size. It also includes one 12,000 square foot building as a sales office and one 1,500 square foot stationary saw station. Expansion of the two existing detention basins is also proposed. The size of the two existing basins are 6,550 cubic feet and 1,050 cubic feet. The proposed size of each of the basins, respectively, would be 13,550 cubic feet and 5,370 cubic feet. There's also a parking modification request, which, based on the calculations pursuant to the ordinance, 113 spaces would be required. Currently existing, there's 20 spaces associated with the use on the northern parcel, the Weirich Lumberyard office, and 50 additional spaces. Based on review of the parking demands, staff considers that existing parking is adequate to serve the use because the use category for the ordinance is building materials and sales, which may include something like a Home Depot, where they're providing a variety of services and products. And this use type is primarily limited to lumber and landscaping material sales. The project site is located in the community of Templeton on the western side of Highway 101, south of the Main Street and 101 interchange. The total parcel is 25 acres, which includes a portion in the residential rural land use category and a portion in the commercial service land use category. The portion outlined in this slide here is the portion that this use permit would be applicable to. No uses are proposed in the residential portion. This is an aerial of a current aerial of the project site, noise mitigation, and exterior lighting standards. This is a slide showing the applicant's proposed structures to be located on the site. The detention basins are located along the south parcel line and the east parcel line. The slide shows the 150-foot setback from that eastern property line, and also structures located along the western side of the parcel to attenuate noise, in addition to placement of the structures in the southern part to help attenuate noise and to limit use of trucks and other equipment in areas that are close to the residential land uses. This is a slide showing an elevation of the proposed pole barns. And the applicant submitted some photo simulations showing what those pole barns would look like. This is a simulation of the existing condition as seen from southbound Highway 1 at the Main Street exit. This is the proposed simulation. This is the existing condition as seen from northbound 101. You can see the lumber yard in the, on the left side of your screen. And this is a simulation of what the structures would look like when they're screening the material. Templeton design standards are applicable to this project. The project was reviewed by TAG, and they recommended approval 7-0. In addition, the project is conditioned to require articulation and some add-on elements to be consistent with the design plan. And based on review by staff, the project is consistent with the design guidelines and standards. As I briefly went over before, noise mitigation, in order to meet the planning area standard regarding noise, the applicant proposes to use walled and insulated structures to attenuate sound at the residential use boundaries. They propose to place structures that limit the use of trucks and equipment near the residential use category, and also install a solid insulated wall around the two saw stations that are located on site, which would attenuate noise. In addition, the applicant's proposing to only operate the yard during daytime hours only. One of the issues that came up during review of this project were the anticipated improvements at the Highway 101 and Main Street interchange. A project study report is currently being initiated by Public Works that's looking at the effects of that interchange and also long-term improvements. As part of review of this project, staff and Public Works met with the applicant to develop an MOU, which requires an easement along the western side of the commercial use category for future dedication of a future road. No improvements are requested by Public Works at this time. In addition, the applicant is required to pay Templeton A road fees for the uses that have been going on unpermitted. In addition, when they build the additional structures, they will be required a building permit to pay additional fees. I have some photos if you haven't been to the site. This is one of the structures on the northern parcel, which was permitted. It just shows an example of, this is a larger structure, but it shows an example of the design the applicant's proposing to implement with the pole barns. This is a structure that would be similar to what they're proposing. And these are all structures that are on the northern parcel. And these are photos internally within the expansion area. It shows the existing stacks of lumber and materials and trucks.
And those will all be moved into the new structures?
Right. All of these, the applicant proposes to contain all their materials in pole barns. The pole barns that are located near the property boundaries would have solid walls to screen the materials, and internally they would just be holes with the roofs to cover the materials.
And so when we read as-built, this is kind of the as-built, the piles of materials and the paving that are already there?
That is correct. So here's some additional photos. Here's a photo of one of the saw operations along the western boundary. And the saw operation along the northern boundary. This is a photo of one of the existing basins. And this is the second smaller basin. This is a photo taken from right off site of the western property boundary. This is the location of where that road easement would go, or the offer to dedicate would be located.
So is this part of the applicant's property here? Is this the rural residential zone?
It is part of the applicant's property. It's one parcel with two land use categories.
Right, so the open space here is the rural residential land use category.
That is correct. And this is a photo of the western and the southern property boundary. This is a photo of the eastern property boundary.
The intent of that change?
Glenn Marshall, County Public Works, I'd be happy to. The intent of the change is, when I was reading through the condition of approval, and actually Bruce Seipel had called me up, and we were looking at this, and the condition as it was written would require about $1 million in road fees. And so I went back and I spoke with our transportation folks, and then also looked at the environmental analysis, and Higgins, who had done the original traffic report, had seen that really that this expansion area would result in about 3 additional PM peak hour trips. So I revised the condition 4 to state that, well, because of the expansion, they're responsible for 3 PM peak hour trips, which is about just over $12,000 in road fees, and then any future building permits that go out that are associated with this, they'll be responsible to pay additional road fees based on those.
I'm just curious how you account for the discrepancy in the two different analyses. I mean,
no discrepancies that I can think of. The
one analysis resulted in $1 million in road impact fees, and the other analysis resulted in $12,000. So,
well, it wasn't really analysis. We just used the trip generation figure of 4.49, and we multiplied it times the whole site. But really, that's not applicable because. Well, we didn't look. I didn't look at it as close as I should have when I wrote this condition and gave it to Shauna. We just applied it to the whole site, and then later on we realized, well, this is ridiculous.
Because that's already existing. It's not going to increase. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then the last change is on page 318, condition 5. Based on staff's consultation with county council, we propose to delete that condition because the parking is located on the parcel to the north that is also owned by the applicant.
Madam Chair, originally we had a shared parking agreement in there, but the applicant owns both the northern parcel and the southern parcel, and so he can't do an agreement with himself. And so after discussions with county council, it was decided that approval of the CUP will hook the two parcels together effectively enough to ensure that we have adequate room for parking for the use in perpetuity.
The way I understand it, this is one parcel with two land use designations on it, or is
no,
that incorrect?
It's actually two parcels, and the southerly parcel has split zoning on it with commercial service to the east and residential rural to the west.
Okay.
Is that clear enough? Should we have Shauna put the category? Okay.
Well, I'm only curious because if we're going to delete this condition, then do we need to add language that authorizes or requires the provision of parking on the adjacent parcel?
We don't think that we do because, like I said, the approval of the CUP will require that the parcels are used together as long as this use is there.
And is there adequate parking?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry. I didn't quite understand your question the first time.
We're good.
So that concludes staff's recommendation is to adopt the negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of CEQA and approve conditional use permit DRC 2007-00024 based on the findings listed, the modified findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B.
Thank you. Questions from commissioners?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just have one clarification question that was on the parking, and just so I make sure that I understand it properly.
We're asking for a waiver of the required parking because the category that bases the numerical requirements is as close as we can get to this use, even though this use really doesn't quite fit in that category. Because the category that used for the calculation is more of a retail sales, where this is more of a storage?
Is that accurate? It's somewhat. There's just a different level. We had to calculate the parking based on the acreage of the outdoor use area, which in this case includes a lot of piles of lumber. So it's not like at some places they have a landscape yard where you have a lot of people going out to buy plants and soil and other materials like that. You know, this is all trucks and lumber, and so there's not the same levels of
not as many customers for retail sales. Then
exactly.
Okay, thank you. That's the way I thought I understood
Great.
It.
Was that it?
Yes.
Eugene, questions?
Nothing.
Over here? Okay. I don't have any speaker slips, but I assume that the applicant is represented here today. If you could fill out a speaker slip before you go so we can get the spelling of your name.
Will do. Madam Chair, Commissioners, I'm Bruce Fraser, Fraser Sackville Architects in San Luis Obispo, and I'm acting as the... As the owner's representative, we prepared the visualization condition 2 of the conditions required within 30 days. The way it's written, it says, within 30 days of permit approval, the applicant shall submit an as-built grading plan to planning and building with complete drainage calculations for review and approval in accordance with 22.52.080. And... we understand the intent there. There's a couple of things just to confirm the understanding. That 30-day period would commence at the end of the appeal period because the approval is really not in place until that point. I just wanted to make sure that everybody agrees with that understanding. The other thing, though, is that what's proposed under this conditional use permit is to do the detailed engineering to expand those two basins. That obviously hasn't been initiated yet. That involves getting percolation testing, creating a drainage model as a basis for engineering, and really putting all of the data together that are required for NPDES confirmation and so on. And that's a pretty hard thing to accomplish in 30 days, even if it wasn't the rainy season and the holidays. So I'd recommend some alternate language, if it's acceptable to the commission, basically saying within 30 days of permit approval, the applicant shall submit an as-built grading plan to the Department of Planning and Building, identifying drainage plans for plan checking in accordance with 22.52.080. Based on drainage calculations, existing drainage basins will be expanded to meet county standards and comply with the requirements of NPDES. And what that does is basically requires what I think the intent of the condition is, that we enter the dialogue specifically with Elizabeth Zabowski in Planning and Building to start the county's kind of concurrent review of existing drainage patterns with the engineering analysis that needs to occur. But then as these storage buildings, the new 12,000-foot building, and the drainage basins are done, they'll proceed at kind of a normal engineering and development pace. Does that make sense?
Why don't we just give you more time, 60 days or 90 days?
It's a little bit of a hard one to put a limit on because access to the site for a meaningful percolation study is weird when it's raining. You can end up having to wait 4 months to really do it right, or you can do it next week.
We'll discuss that with staff.
Okay. The intent is to initiate dialogue and get the analysis started at the staff level. And I think that's amenable from the developer's point of view. And that's really about it. I think we discussed with Glenn the condition 4 and agree with his proposed change. There is some conflicting language inside of the staff report and the conditions about where this 50-foot dedication is anticipated. Only in that it's referred to at the westerly property edge, and that's not a property edge, as you just discussed amongst yourselves. That's a zone line. So it's at the west edge of the zone line, really, where this is discussed. But again, it will have its own discussion, and that will be clarified at that time. So I don't think that that's really needs to be rewritten for purposes of these conditions. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions for the applicant's agent at this time?
No.
Okay, I would just remind you to please fill out a speaker slip at the back of the room and turn it into one of our staff. Thank you very much. Don't have any other requests to speak slips on this item, so bring it back to staff and the commission. I think there's only, well, there's one identified issue to deal with, and that's the 30 days. So, Mr. Nall, you have a...
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to punt to Glenn on the drainage basin. As far as planning staff is concerned, we don't have a problem, Glenn, giving the applicant more time to do that, but I thought you're the expert here. You take it away.
Gee, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Glenn Russell, County Public Works. Actually, I wrote this condition, as I did number 4, which I changed. This one, the intent of the condition was they had done some grading and paving, and they had done it without a permit, is my understanding, so the county never looked at their drainage. And so what we're trying to do is, did the basins they build, and I believe they did construct basins on the site, are they adequate? Do they meet county standards? So that, and then Elizabeth was telling me during in the staff report, they're talking about approving additional projects. And therein lies the problem is, we kind of want to make sure what they did meets our county standards, and it'd be fine if they want to incorporate it with what they're proposing to do as well. And so I just kind of...
Too adequate to meet county standards, correct?
Right.
So,
well, and what they have done, although I'm unfamiliar with what they've got, we've gotten any complaints from drainage because of what they've done on their site. It's kind of vacant land of the south, which is the historic drainage pattern. And does it meet our standards? What they did without a permit, does that meet our current standards? And really that's the intent. Maybe we make it as simple as that is. Go ahead.
I'm concerned that I'm missing something because I kind of think whether they meet our current standards or whether they don't, as built, is kind of moot. So what? Whether they meet our current standards or not, because what they're going to do is go in and make those basins substantially larger.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is the new drainage pond design adequate to meet county standards and adequate to handle the runoff from the site?
And what you're saying makes perfect sense. And yes, I guess that would be fine.
Let me jump in here. Maybe I
sure.
Maybe I think I understand this. I think what engineering is asking for is what's currently existing there. Do those basins that currently exist suffice for the run, the drainage that's there? As the project's built out with the pole barns, it will increase the runoff. So that's when the expansion of the basins will need to be verified that they meet the new development runoffs. Is that accurate? You're trying to establish what the existing...
In general, they took earth and they paved it. And now they're going to put pole barns on top of the pavement, so it really isn't going to change anything. But what they did is they potentially increased the amount of runoff to county facilities and to Caltrans facilities in an area of Templeton where we already have existing drainage problems. So as long as they built those basins on site to county standards, then we can say, oh, the downstream impacts are probably negligible. But we don't know that because they just built it. They built something. Did they build it right? Probably, because we haven't heard of anything. But
if we found out that those current basins had been built to county standards, then would we not authorize the expansion of those
of
the ponds?
Oh, bigger is better in this case, yes.
It's a small thing, but, they're gonna like in one case quintuple the size of one of those basins. So if that's what they're gonna do, it seems like what we want to see is a drainage plan that shows that those bigger expanded basins are going to be adequate to handle the runoff from the paved areas and the roofs. That to me seems like the only drainage question that we really
and that's okay. That's what you see. But what I was saying is they've done something without the correct permit process without the correct...
Okay. And I'm assuming they've gotten whatever, fines or penalties or I don't know what sort of enforcement action was taken, but you know, clearly they did it without a permit, and that's why they're here, to get a permit to make it legal. I mean, so they do an engineering report for the existing basins, and it turns out they're completely inadequate. So what? We'll just say, well, yeah, they're inadequate, but they're going to make them bigger. Are the bigger ones going to be big enough?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it seems like there could be some interim time period, maybe between the construction of the new structures and the bigger basins.
They may come in for permits 2 years.
It's useful to know.
It's not going to all be done at once?
Well, between now and when these structures in the new basins are built, could be some lag. So
I see.
We could want to know that the existing basins are adequate for any lag time.
Thank
you. Possible difference between where you're at and where you're at.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know. I'm not suggesting that's possible.
Does staff concur? Is that the intent of that?
It's a timing issue.
Thing?
These are within a time frame, and then as you notice in condition 6, it just says come in for a building permit. There's no time related to when he can come in for those building permits. So, yeah, it's a timing issue.
But I am open to additional time.
In that case, given the fact that there may be years where we're still sitting there with those existing basins, the question of whether or not they're adequate seems pretty significant.
Relevant.
And so we should have not a completely open-ended timeline, which I sort of think was what the applicant was proposing.
It sounded like they wanted more flexibility. So it seemed, my guess is, that we might agree that maybe more than 30 days,
right.
But maybe not than 4 months,
right.
Or completely open-ended. So given that we do have an as-built sort of situation, I would suggest
4 months.
4 months would be an outside long period of time, and maybe given that rainy season is coming, 3 or 4 should seem pretty adequate.
So 120 days, and that brings us to very much April. Mr. Nall?
Madam Chair, if we went a whole 6 months, then the applicant would have that required dry time to do the percolation tests, whereas if we make it 120 days, they could get stuck in a rainy season and not be able to do the perk test, and then we wouldn't have the...
So the offer was going to be, as I recall, for 50 feet between the RR and the CS zones, basically between the green and the purple, running in north-south direction, and then Mr. Wire came in and spoke with the transportation myself, and my understanding is we agreed to put it to the far westerly property line, and I believe it was a 25-foot offer? It may still be a 50-foot. Nope, still a 50-foot, but it's on the far westerly property line, all within residential rural, and I believe that was the applicant who wanted that. And
does that meet Caltrans's concerns?
It does. Basically, Caltrans' concerns is getting the intersection of, well, basically getting Theater Drive as far away from the interchange as possible. 600 feet is our standard, and this would move it well beyond 600 feet.
Okay.
And we're just looking at this from a future circulation, whether we ever, when we build the road, and whether it actually goes there, it's unclear at this point.
And actually, the applicant's agent was seeking clarification whether that was the edge of the property line or the edge of the zone line.
I believe it to be the edge of the property line, based on my conversation, but now I'm seeing they want it at the edge of the zone line.
Excuse me, maybe everyone else is clear. Apologies. What are we trying to accomplish here? We're looking at an easement for...
Yeah, eventually we're going to realign Theater Drive, continue it from Main Street southerly to intersect with Peterson Ranch Road. That's part of the circulation element.
So it's moving it somewhere west of what it currently is.
Exactly. The frontage, eventually it'll be abandoned out front along the frontage road portion, and it'll be shifted left. And so if the applicant wants, maybe this would be a good time to hear from the applicant to see.
So if it's to the... Oh.
Well, so it would make sense then with that change from commercial and PF to RR to have...
Yeah, the difference is it would be west of the CS and PF categories or west of the RR.
Yeah
and there have been multiple discussions in the past. The fact is Mr. Warwick's preference and their understanding of where it currently is the west edge of the zone, of the CS zone line. So that's, we have thought it was both things at different times, but that's actually what everybody's preference is right now, is that it be to the line where it changes from CS to RR.
Do we need a language and a condition?
Well, I'll go back to my original condition with the referral. I can read that into the record, which had it pretty much at that location in between the RR and the CS zoning.
And that was the location that Shauna showed on your PowerPoint. That picture was that category boundary.
So do we need to hear that language?
If that's the direction we'll go. It's for future road purposes, a 50-foot wide right-of-way to be described as 25 feet either side of a center line commencing 25 feet westerly of the southeasterly property corner of PM 492 parcel 1 and traversing the project site in a southerly direction until terminating at the southerlymost property line on the project site.
And that's condition number what?
That'll be... Thank you.
I don't know, though. Did you read that way? That's in between the zones on the site?
No. I heard it. That sounded more like the westerly the parcel.
No, the top one.
Yeah. It's...
Look at the top one. Could we just see that again?
Category boundary again, Shauna.
Use the little arrow indicate, please.
There it is. And see, the confusion is that's not really a property boundary, that's a category boundary.
Right.
The property boundary is to the west, at the left end of the RR.
Right.
And that's the confusion.
Show us where Mr. Wyrick wants the easement. There. Right. Okay.
There it is.
But I just, that's why I heard property boundary and the condition.
This property boundary right there. Yeah, right. That corner of the property boundary is there and there. But then when you go through this, it's not a property boundary.
Well, I know it's not,
but then he doesn't describe it.
I'm defining the starting point as being the corner of the northerly bordering properties.
Okay.
Because there is no starting point kind of in there.
Okay.
And then moving directly south, and it's 50 feet either side.
Okay, as long as everyone else is clear on what it's saying. You're very clear.
Yeah. As clear as I was in condition four.
Okay. Are there any other issues for this project that commissioners would like to discuss?
The noise was the one issue that came up, and we don't have anybody here to address it, but I'm guessing that must be complaint-driven because there are a couple of residences not too far from the site. And so we've heard about noise from both forklift and truck noise and the saws. And so I know there are mitigations in the plan to kind of put the solid walls and stone on the outside. And
yeah.
Right, I did read that. So given that no one's here to complain. But
okay. So we've got a change to finding A. We've got new language for condition 4. We're deleting condition 5, and we're amending condition 2 to bump it up to 120 days.
No, 186 months.
Oh, 6 months.
Should we call it 180 days?
Well, it's in days now, so it's 180 days. And we weren't making any changes to the language in 3. We were going with what Mr. Marshall read into the record.
What I read into the record.
Right, okay.
For number 3 to replace condition 3.
Okay, so I think we're ready for a motion.
I'll make a motion that we adopt a negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section 21,000, et cetera. Approved conditional use permit, DRC 2007-00024, based on the revised findings listed in Exhibit A, and the revised conditions as read in the record listed in Exhibit B.
It's been moved by Commissioner White and seconded by Commissioner Melskow. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Yes.
Chairperson Christie?
Yes. The project is approved. Okay, that concludes all of our public hearing items for the day. I don't believe we have any items to continue. We do need a motion to include everything in the record today. I don't actually think we took any information in the record today, so maybe we can skip that one. So I think we're just going to call the December 10th meeting.
Probably should continue this meeting to the one next Thursday.
Are we continuing this meeting to next Thursday? It's not a separate hearing?
It'll be an adjourned regular meeting next, because it's not a regular scheduled meeting day.
Okay. So we're going to adjourn this meeting to December 17th. Thank you all.